themselves, chatting about the training Luca was to do with some of the sentries on the battlements that day, the meat pies Emrys would make for lunch, the oncoming spring rains that might ruin the Beltane festival like last year. Such ordinary things to talk about, worry about. And they were so easy with each other, a family in their own way. Uncorrupted by a wicked empire, by years of brutality and slavery and bloodshed, she could almost see the three souls in the kitchen lined up beside each other. Theirs bright and clear, hers a flickering black flame. Do not let that light go out. Nehemia's last words to her that night in the tunnels. Selena pushed around the food on her plate. She'd never known anyone whose life hadn't been overshadowed by Otterlin. She could barely remember her brief years before the continent had been enslaved, when Terrasen had still been free. She could not remember what it was like to be free. A pit yawned open beneath her feet, so deep that she had to move lest it swallow her whole. She was about to get started on the dishes when Luca said from down the table, "So you either have to be very important or very unlucky to have Rowan training you to enter Doranel." Damned was more like it, but she kept her mouth shut. Emrys was looking on with cautious interest. "That is what you're training for, right? Isn't that why you're all here?" The words came out flatter than she even expected. Luca said, "Yes, but I've got years until I learn whether I've met their qualifications." Years. Years? Maeve couldn't mean for her to be here that long. She looked at Emrys. "How long have you been training?" The old man snorted. "Oh, I was about 15 when I came here, and worked for them for about 10 years. And I was never worthy enough. Too ordinary. Then I decided I'd rather have a home and my own kitchen here than to be looked down upon in Doranel for the rest of my days. It didn't hurt that my mate felt the same way. You'll meet him soon enough. He's always popping in to steal food for himself and his men." He chuckled, and Luca grinned. Mate, not husband. The Fae had mates, an unbreakable bond, deeper than marriage, that lasted beyond death. Selena asked, "So you're all half-breeds?" Luca stiffened, but flashed a smile as he said, "Only the pure-blooded Fae call us that. We prefer demi-Fae. But yes, most of us were born to mortal mothers, with the fathers unaware they'd sired us. The gifted ones usually get snatched away to Doranel, but for us common offspring, the humans still aren't comfortable with us. So we go here. We come to Mistward. Or to the other border outposts. Few enough get permission to go to Doranel that most just come here to live among their own kind." Luca's eyes narrowed on her ears. "Looks like you've got more human in you than Fae." "Because I'm not half." She didn't want to share any more details than that.
"Can you shift?"
Luca asked. Emrys shot him a warning look. "Can you?" she asked.
"Oh no, neither of us can. If we could, we'd probably be in Doranel with the other gifted offspring that Maeve likes to collect."
Emrys growled.
"Careful, Luca. Maeve doesn't deny it, so why should I? That's what Bass and the others are saying, too. Anyway, there are a few sentries here who have secondary forms, like Malachi, Emrys's mate, and they're here because they want to be."
She wasn't at all surprised that Maeve took an interest in the gifted ones, or that Maeve locked all the useless ones out. "And do either of you have gifts?"
"You mean magic?"
Luca said, his mouth quirking to the side.
"Oh, no. Neither of us got a lick of it. I heard your continent always had more wielders than we did anyway, and more variety.
Say, is it true that it's all gone over there?
She nodded. Luca let out a low whistle. He opened his mouth to ask more, but she wasn't particularly in the mood to talk about it, so she said,
Does anyone at this fortress have magic?
Maybe they'd be able to tell her what to expect with Rowan and Maeve. Luca shrugged.
Some. They've only got a hint of boring stuff, like encouraging plants to grow, or finding water, or convincing rain to come. Not that we need it here.
They'd be of no assistance with Rowan or Maeve, then. Wonderful.
But, Luca chattered on, no one here has any exciting or rare abilities, like shape-shifting into whatever form they want, or controlling fire.
Her stomach clenched at that.
Or oracular sight. We did have a female wander in with raw magic 2 years ago. She could do anything she wanted, summon any element. And she was here a week before Maeve called her to Doranelle, and we never heard from her again.
A shame.
She was so pretty, too. But it's the same here as it is everywhere else. A few people with a pathetic trace of elemental powers that are really only fun for farmers.
Emrys clicked his tongue.
You should pray the gods don't strike you with lightning for speaking like that.
Luca groaned, rolling his eyes, but Emrys continued his lecture, gesturing at the youth with his teacup.
Those powers were gifts given to us by them long ago. Gifts we needed to survive, and were passed down through the generations. Of course they'd be aligned with the elements, and of course they'd be watered down after so long.
Selena glanced toward those iron figurines on the mantel. She contemplated mentioning that some believed the gods had also bred with ancient humans and given them magic that way. But that would involve more talking than necessary. She tilted her head to the side.
What do you know about Rowan? How old is he?
The more she learned, the better. Emrys wrapped his wrinkled hands around his teacup.
He's one of the few Fae we see around Mistward. He stops in every now and then to retrieve reports for Maeve, but he keeps to himself. Never stays the night. Occasionally he'll come with the others like him. There are 6 of them who closely serve the Queen as war leaders or spies, you see. They never talk to us, and all we hear are rumors about where they go and what they do. But I've known Rowan since I first came here. Not that I really know him, mind you. Sometimes he's gone for years, off serving Her Majesty. And I don't think anyone knows how old he is. When I was 15, the oldest people living here had known him since they were younglings, so I'd say he's very old.
And as mean as an adder, Luca muttered. Emrys gave him a warning look.
You'd best mind your tongue.
He glanced toward the doors, as if Rowan would be lurking there. When his gaze fell again on Selena, it was wary.
I'll admit that you're probably in for a good heap of difficulty.
He's a stone-cold killer and a sadist is what he means, Luca added. The meanest of Maeve's personal cabal of warriors, they say. Well, that wasn't a surprise either. But there were 5 others like him. That was an unpleasant fact. She said quietly,
I can handle him.
We're not allowed to learn the old language until we enter Doranelle, Luca said. But I heard his tattoo is a list of all the people he slaughtered.
Hush, Emrys said.
It's not like he doesn't act like it. Luca frowned again at Selena. Maybe you should consider whether Doranelle is worth it, you know? It's not so bad living here. She'd already had enough interacting.
I can handle him, she repeated.
Maeve couldn't intend to keep her here for years. If that started to seem likely, Selena would leave and find another way to stop the king. Luca opened his mouth, but Emrys hushed him again.
his gaze falling on Selena's scarred hands.
Let her run her own course.
Luca started chattering about the weather, and Selena headed to the mountain of dishes. As she washed, she fell into a rhythm, as she'd done while cleaning her weapons aboard that ship. The kitchen sounds turned muffled as she let herself spiral down, contemplating that horrible realization again and again. She could not remember what it was like to be free. Chapter 12. The Blackbeak clan was the last to fully assemble at the Farian Gap. As a result, they got the smallest and farthest rooms in the Warren of Halls carved into the Omega. The last of the Rune Mountains, and the northernmost of the Sister Peaks flanking the snow-blasted pass. Across the gap was the Northern Fang, the final peak of the White Fangs, which was currently occupied by the King's men, massive brutes who still didn't know quite what to make of the witches who had stalked in from every direction. They'd been here for a day, and Manon had yet to glimpse any sign of the wyverns the king had promised. She'd heard them, even though they were housed across the pass in the Northern Fang. No matter how deep you got into the Omega stone halls, the shrieks and roars vibrated in the stone. The air pulsed with the boom of leathery wings, and the floors hissed with the scrape of talon on rock. It had been 500 years since all three clans had assembled. There had been over 20,000 of them at one point. Now only 3,000 remained, and that was a generous estimate. All that was left of a once mighty kingdom. Still, the halls of the Omega were a dangerous place to be. Already she'd had to pull apart Asterin and a Yellowlegs bitch who hadn't yet learned that Blackbeak sentinels, especially members of the 13, didn't take lightly to being called soft-hearted. There had been blue blood splattered on their faces, and though Manon was more than pleased to see that Asterin, beautiful, brash Asterin, had done most of the damage, she'd still had to punish her second. 3 unblocked blows. 1 to the gut, so Asterin could feel her own powerlessness. 1 to the ribs, so she'd consider her actions every time she drew breath. And 1 to the face, so her broken nose would remind her that the punishment could have been far worse. Asterin had taken them all without scream or complaint or plea, just as any of the 13 would have done. And this morning, her second, nose swollen and bruised at the bridge, had given Manon a fierce grin over their miserable breakfast of boiled oats. Had it been another witch, Manon would have dragged her by the neck to the front of the room and made her regret the insolence. But Asterin, even though Asterin was her cousin, she wasn't a friend. Manon didn't have friends. None of the witches, especially the 13, had friends. But Asterin had guarded her back for a century, and the grin was a sign that she wouldn't put a dagger in Manon's spine the next time they were knee-deep in battle. No. Asterin was just insane enough to wear the broken nose like a badge of honor, and would love her crooked nose for the rest of her not-so-immortal life. The Yellowleg's heir, a haughty bull of a witch named Iskra, had merely given her offending sentinel a warning to keep her mouth shut, and sent her down to the infirmary in the belly of the mountain. Fool. All the coven leaders were under orders to keep their sentinels in line, to suppress the fighting between clans, or else the 3 matrons would come down on them like a hammer. Without punishment, without Iskra making an example of her, the offending witch would keep at it until she got strung up by her toes by the new High Witch of the Yellowlegs clan. They'd held a sham of a memorial service last night for Baba Yellowlegs in the cavernous mess hall, lighting any old candles in lieu of the traditional black ones, wearing whatever hoods they could find, and going through the sacred words to the 3-faced goddess as though they were reading a recipe. Manon had never met Baba Yellowlegs, and didn't particularly care that she'd died. She was more interested in who had killed her, and why. They all were. And it was those questions that were exchanged between the expected words of loss and mourning. Asterin and Vesta had done the talking, as they usually did, chatting up the other witches while Manon listened from nearby. No one knew anything, though. Even her two shadows, concealed in the dark pockets of the mess hall as they'd been trained to do, had overheard nothing. It was the not knowing that made her shoulders tight, as Manon stalked up the sloped hallway to where the matrons and all the coven leaders were to assemble, Blackbeak and Yellowlegs witches stepping aside to let her pass. She resented not knowing anything that might be useful, that might give the 13 or the Blackbeaks an advantage. Of course, the Bluebloods were nowhere to be seen. The reclusive witches had arrived first and claimed the uppermost rooms in the Omega, saying they needed the mountain breeze to complete their rituals every day. Religious fanatics with their noses in the wind was what Mother Blackbeak had always called them. But it had been their insane devotion to the three-faced goddess and their vision of the witch kingdom under Iron Teeth rule that had mustered the clans 5 centuries ago, even if it had been the Blackbeak sentinels who'd won the battles for them. Manon treated her body as she would any other weapon. She kept it clean and honed and ready at any time to defend and destroy. But even her training couldn't keep her from being out of breath when she reached the atrium by the Black Bridge that connected the Omega to the Northern Fang. She hated the expanse of stone without even touching it. It smelled wrong. It smelled like those two prisoners she'd seen with the Duke. In fact, this whole place reeked like that. The scent wasn't natural. It didn't belong in this world. About 50 witches, the highest-ranking coven leaders in each clan, were gathered at the giant hole in the side of the mountain. Manon spotted her grandmother immediately, standing at the bridge entrance with what had to be the Blueblood and Yellowlegs matrons. The new Yellowlegs matron was supposedly some half-sister of Baba, and she certainly looked the part. Huddled in brown robes, saffron ankles peeking out, white hair braided back to reveal a wrinkled, brutal face mottled with age. By rule, all Yellowlegs wore their iron teeth and nails on permanent display, and the new high witches were shining in the dull morning light. Unsurprisingly, the Blueblood matron was tall and willowy, more priestess than warrior. She wore the traditional deep blue robes, and a band of iron stars circled her brow. As Manon approached the crowd, she could see that the stars were barbed. Not surprising, either. Legend had it that all witches had been gifted by the three-faced goddess with iron teeth and nails to keep them anchored to this world when magic threatened to pull them away. The Iron Crown, supposedly, was proof that the magic in the Blue Blood line ran so strong that their leader needed more, needed iron and pain, to keep her tethered in this realm. Nonsense, especially when magic had been gone these past 10 years. But Manon had heard rumors of the rituals the Blue Bloods did in their forests and caves. Rituals in which pain was the gateway to magic, to opening their senses. Oracles, mystics, zealots. Manon stalked through the ranks of the assembled Blackbeak coven leaders. They were the most numerous, 20 coven leaders, over which Manon ruled with her 13. Each leader touched 2 fingers to her brow in deference. She ignored them and took up a spot at the front of the crowd, where her grandmother gave her an acknowledging glance. An honor, for any high witch to acknowledge an individual. Manon bowed her head, pressing 2 fingers to her brow. Obedience, discipline, and brutality were the most beloved words in the Blackbeak clan. All else was to be extinguished without second thought. She still had her chin high, hands behind her back, when she spotted the 2 other heirs watching her. The blue blood heir, Petra, stood closest to the high witches, her group in the center of the crowd. Manon stiffened but held her gaze. Her freckled skin was as pale as Manon's, and her braided hair was as golden as Asterin's, a deep, brassy color that caught the gray light. She was beautiful, like so many of them, but grave. Above her blue eyes, a worn leather band rested on her brow in lieu of the iron star crown. There was no way of telling how old she was, but she couldn't be much older than Manon if she looked this way after magic had vanished. There was no aggression, but no smile either. Smiles were rare amongst witches, unless you were on the hunt or on a killing field. The yellow legs heir, though. Iskra was grinning at Manon, bristling with a challenge that Manon found herself aching to meet. Iskra hadn't forgotten the brawl between their sentinels in the hallway yesterday. If anything, from the look in Iskra's brown eyes, it seemed that the brawl had been an invitation. Manon found herself debating how much trouble she'd get into for shredding the throat of the Yellowlegs' heir. It would put an end to any fights between their sentinels. It would also put an end to her life if the attack were unprovoked. Witch justice was swift. Dominance battles could end in loss of life, but the claim had to be made up front. Without a formal provocation from Iskra, Manon's hands were tied. "Now that we're assembled," the blue blood matron, Cressida, said, drawing Manon's attention, "shall we show you what we've been brought here to do?" Mother Blackbeak waved a hand to the bridge, black robes billowing in the icy wind. "We walk into the sky, witches." The crossing of the Black Bridge was more harrowing than Manon wanted to admit. First, there was the miserable stone, which throbbed beneath her feet, giving off that reek that no one else seemed to notice. Then there was the screeching wind, which battered them this way and that, trying to shove them over the carved railing. They couldn't even see the floor of the gap. Mist shrouded everything below the bridge, a mist that hadn't vanished in the day they'd been here, or the days they'd hiked up the gap. It was, she supposed, some trick of the king's. Contemplating it led only to more questions, none of which she bothered to voice, or really care about all that much. By the time they reached the cavernous atrium of the Northern Fang, Manon's ears were frozen and her face was raw. She'd flown at high altitudes in all kinds of weather, but not for a long while. Not without a fresh belly of meat in her, keeping her warm. She wiped her runny nose on the shoulder of her red cloak. She'd seen the other coven leaders eyeing the crimson material, as they always did, with yearning and scorn and envy. Iskra had gazed at it the longest, sneering. It would be nice, really damn nice, to peel off the Yellowleg's heir's face one day. They reached the gaping mouth into the upper reaches of the Northern Fang. Here the stone was scarred and gouged, splattered with the triple goddess knew what. From the tang of it, it was blood. Human blood. 5 men, all looking hewn from the same scarred stone themselves, met the 3 matrons with grim nods. Manon fell into step behind her grandmother, one eye on the men, the other on their surroundings. The other 2 heirs did the same. At least they agreed on that. As heirs, their foremost duty was to protect their high witches, even if it meant sacrificing themselves. Manon glanced at the Yellowlegs matron, who held herself just as proudly as the 2 ancients as they walked into the shadows of the mountain. But Manon didn't take her hand off her blade, Wind Cleaver, for a heartbeat. The screams and wing beats and clank of metal were far louder here.
"This is where we breed and train 'em until they can make the crossing to the Omega," one of the men was saying,
gesturing to the many cave mouths they passed as they strode through the cavernous hall.
Hatcheries are in the belly of the mountain, a level above the forges for the armory. To keep the eggs warm, you see. Dens are a level above that. We keep them separated by gender and type. The bulls we hold in their own pens unless we want to breed them. They kill anyone in their cages. Learned that the hard way.
The men chuckled, but the witches did not. He went on about the different types. The bulls were the best, but a female could be just as fierce and twice as smart. The smaller ones were good for stealth and had been bred to be totally black against the night sky, or a pale blue to blend into daylight patrols. The average wyvern's colors they didn't care about so much, since they wanted their enemies to drop dead from terror, the man claimed. They descended steps carved into the stone itself, and if the reek of blood and waste didn't overwhelm every sense, then the din of the wyverns, a roaring and screeching and booming of wings and flesh on rock, nearly drowned out the man's words. But Manon stayed focused on her grandmother's position, on the positions of the others around her. And she knew that Asterin, one step behind her, was doing the same for her. He led them onto a viewing platform in a massive cavern. The sunken floor was at least 40 feet below, one end of the chamber wholly open to the cliff face, the other sealed with an iron grate. No, a door.
This is one of the training pits, the man explained. It's easy to sort out the natural-born killers, but we discover a lot of them show their mettle in the pits. Before you, ladies, he said, trying to hide his wince at the word, even lay eyes on them, they'll be in here fighting it out.
And when, said Mother Blackbeak, pinning him with a stare, will we select our mounts? The man swallowed.
We train a brood of gentler ones to teach you the basics.
A growl from Iskra. Manon might also have snarled at the implied insult, but the blue blood matron spoke. You don't learn to ride by hopping on a war horse, do you? The man almost sagged with relief.
Once you're comfortable with the flying.
We were born on the back of the wind, said one of the coven leaders in the back. Some grunts of approval. Manon kept silent, as did her Blackbeak coven leaders. Obedience, discipline, brutality. They did not descend to boasting. The man fidgeted and kept his focus on Cressida, as if she were the only safe one in the room, even with her barbed crown of stars. Idiot. Manon sometimes thought the blue bloods were the deadliest of them all.
Soon as you're ready, he said, we can begin the selection process. Get you on your mounts and start the training.
Manon risked taking her eyes off her grandmother to study the pit. There were giant chains anchored in one of the walls, and enormous splotches of dark blood stained the stones, as if one of these beasts had been pushed against it. A giant crack spiderwebbed from the center. Whatever hit the wall had been tossed hard.
What are the chains for?
Manon found herself asking. Her grandmother gave her a warning look, but Manon focused on the man. Predictably, his eyes widened at her beauty, then stayed wide as he beheld the death lurking beneath it.
Chains are for the bait beasts, he said. They're the wyverns we use to show the others how to fight, to turn their aggression into a weapon. We're under orders not to put any of them down, even the runts and broken ones, so we put the weaklings to good use.
Just like dog fighting. She looked again to the splotch and the crack in the wall. The bait beast had probably been thrown by one of the bigger ones. And if the wyverns could hurl each other like that, then the damage to humans. Her chest tightened with anticipation, especially as the man said,
Wanna see a bull? A glimmer of iron nails as Cressida made an elegant gesture to continue. The man let out a sharp whistle. None of them spoke as chains rattled, a whip cracked, and the iron gate to the pit groaned as it lifted. And then, heralded by men with whips and spears, the wyvern appeared. A collective intake of breath, even from Manon.
"Titus is one of our best," the man said, pride gleaming in his voice.
Manon couldn't tear her eyes away from the gorgeous beast, his mottled gray body covered in a leathery hide, his massive back legs armed with talons as big as her forearm, and his enormous wings, tipped with a claw and used to propel him forward like a front set of limbs. The triangular head swiveled this way and that, and his dripping maw revealed yellow, curved fangs.
"Tails armed with a venomous barb,"
the man said, as the wyvern emerged fully from the pit, snarling at the men down there with him. The reverberations of the snarl echoed through the stone, into her boots and up her legs, right into her husk of a heart. A chain was clamped around his back leg, undoubtedly to keep him from flying out of the pit. The tail, as long as his body and tipped with two curved spikes, flicked back and forth like a cat's.
"They can fly hundreds of miles in a day and still be ready to fight when they arrive,"
the man said. And the witches all hissed in a breath. That sort of speed and endurance.
"What do they eat?"
asked Petra, freckled face still calm and grave. The man rubbed his neck.
"They'll eat anything, but they like it fresh."
"So do we,"
said Iskra with a grin. Had anyone but the Yellowlegs heir said it, Manon would have joined in with the other grins around her. Titus gave a sudden thrash, lunging for the nearest man while using his magnificent tail to snap the raised spears behind him. A whip cracked, but it was too late. Blood and screams and the crunch of bone. The man's legs and head tumbled to the ground. The torso was swallowed down in one bite. The smell of blood filled the air, and every single one of the Iron Teeth witches inhaled deeply. The man in front of them took a too casual step away. The bull in the pit was now looking up at them, tail still slashing against the floor. Magic was gone, and yet this was possible, this creation of magnificent beasts. Magic was gone, and yet Manon felt the sureness of the moment settle along her bones. She was meant to be here. She'd have Titus or no other, because she'd suffer no creature to be her mount but the fiercest, the one whose blackness called to her own. As her eyes met with the endless dark of Titus's, she smiled at the wyvern. She could have sworn he smiled back.
Chapter 13. Selena didn't realize how exhausted she was until all sounds, Emrys's soft singing from the table, the thud of dough as he kneaded it, the chopping of Luca's knife and his ceaseless chatter about everything and anything, stopped. And she knew what she'd find when she turned toward the stairwell. Her hands were pruny, fingers aching, back and neck throbbing, but Rowan was leaning against the archway of the stairwell, arms crossed and violence beckoning in his lifeless eyes.
"Let's go."
Though his features remained cold, she had the distinct impression that he was somewhat annoyed at her for not sulking in a corner, bemoaning the state of her nails. As she left, Luca drew a finger across his neck as he mouthed, "Good luck." Rowan led her through a small courtyard, where sentries tried to pretend they weren't watching their every move, and out into the forest.
The ward magic woven between the ring of megaliths again nipped at her skin as they passed, and nausea washed through her. Without the constant heat of the kitchen, she was half frozen by the time they strode between the moss-coated trees. But even that was only a vague flicker of feeling. Rowan trekked up a rocky ridge toward the highest reaches of the forest, still clouded in mist. She barely paused to take in the view of the foothills below, the plains before them, all green and fresh and safe from Otterlin. Rowan didn't utter a single word until they reached what looked like the weathered-stained ruins of a temple. It was now no more than a flatbed of stone blocks and columns whose carvings had been dulled by wind and rain. To her left lay Wendlin, foothills and plains and peace. To her right arose the wall of the Cambrian Mountains, blocking any sight of the immortal lands beyond. Behind her, far down, she could make out the fortress snaking along the spine of the mountain. Rowan crossed the cracked stones, his silver hair battered by the crisp, damp wind. She kept her arms loose at her sides, more out of reflex than anything. He was armed to the teeth, his face a mask of unyielding brutality. She made herself give a little smile, her best attempt at a dutiful, eager expression. Do your worst. He looked her over from head to toe. The mist-damp shirt, now icy against her puckered skin. The equally stained and damp pants. The position of her feet. Wipe that smarmy, lying smile off your face. His voice was as dead as his eyes, but it had a razor-sharp bite behind it. She kept her smarmy, lying smile. I don't know what you're talking about. He stepped toward her, the canines coming out this time. Here's your first lesson, girl. Cut the horseshit. I don't feel like dealing with it, and I'm probably the only one who doesn't give a damn about how angry and vicious and awful you are underneath.
I don't think you particularly want to see how angry and vicious and awful I am underneath.
Go ahead and be as nasty as you want, princess, because I've been 10 times as nasty, for 10 times longer than you've been alive.
She didn't let it out. No. Because he truly didn't understand a thing about what lurked under her skin and ran claws down her insides. But she stopped any attempt to control her features. Her lips pulled back from her teeth.
Better. Now shift.
She didn't bother to sound pleasant as she said, It's not something I can control.
If I wanted excuses, I'd ask for them. Shift.
She didn't know how. She had never mastered it as a child, and there certainly hadn't been any opportunities to learn in the past decade. I hope you brought snacks. Because we're going to be here a long, long while if today's lesson is dependent upon my shifting.
You're really going to make me enjoy training you.
She had a feeling he could have switched out training you for eating you alive. I've already participated in 12 versions of the Master-Disciple training saga, so why don't we cut that horseshit too? His smile turned quieter. More lethal.
Shut your smart-ass mouth and shift.
A shuddering rush went through her, a spear of lightning in the abyss.
No.
And then he attacked. She'd contemplated his blows all morning, the way he'd moved, the swiftness and angles. So she dodged the first blow, sidestepping his fist. Strands of her hair snapping in the wind. She even twisted far enough in the other direction to avoid the second strike. But he was so damn fast she could barely register the movements. So fast that she had no chance of dodging or blocking or anticipating the third blow. Not to her face, but to her legs. just as he had the night before. One sweep of his foot, and she was falling, twisting to catch herself, but not fast enough to avoid thudding her brow against a weather-smooth rock. She rolled, the gray sky looming, and tried to remember how to breathe as the impact echoed through her skull. Rowan pounced with fluid ease, his powerful thighs digging into her ribs as he straddled her. Breathless, head reeling, and muscles drained from a morning in the kitchen and weeks of hardly eating, she couldn't twist and toss him, couldn't do anything. She was outweighed, outmuscled, and for the first time in her life, she realized she was utterly outmatched. "Shift," he hissed. She laughed up at him, a dead, wretched sound even to her own ears. "Nice try." Gods, her head throbbed. A warm trickle of blood was leaking from the right side of her brow, and he was now sitting on her chest. She laughed again, strangled by his weight. "You think you can trick me into shifting by pissing me off?" He snarled, his face speckled with the stars floating in her vision. Every blink shot daggers of pain through her. It would probably be the worst black eye of her life. "Here's an idea. I'm rich as hell," she said over the pounding in her head. "How about we pretend to do this training for a week or so, and then you tell Maeve I'm good and ready to enter her territory, and I'll give you all the goddamned gold you want." He brought his canines so close to her neck that one movement would have him ripping out her throat. "Here's an idea," he growled. "I don't know what the hell you've been doing for 10 years, other than flouncing around and calling yourself an assassin. But I think you're used to getting your way. I think you have no control over yourself. No control and no discipline. Not the kind that counts deep down. You are a child, and a spoiled one at that. And," he said, those green eyes holding nothing but distaste, "you are a coward." Had her arms not been pinned, she would have clawed his face off right then. She struggled, trying every technique she'd ever learned to dislodge him, but he didn't move an inch. A low, nasty laugh. "Don't like that word?" He leaned closer still, that tattoo of his swimming in her muddled vision. "Coward. You're a coward who has run for 10 years while innocent people were burned and butchered and—" She stopped hearing him. She just stopped. It was like being underwater again, like charging into Nehemia's room and finding that beautiful body mutilated on the bed. Like seeing Galen Ashriver, beloved and brave, riding off into the sunset to the cheers of his people. She lay still, watching the churning clouds above, waiting for him to finish the words she couldn't hear, waiting for a blow she was fairly certain she wouldn't feel. "Get up," he said suddenly, and the world was bright and wide as he stood. "Get up." Get up. Kaol had said that to her once, when pain and fear and grief had shoved her over an edge. But the edge she'd gone over the night Nehemia had died, the night she'd gutted Archer, the day she'd told Kaol the horrible truth. Kaol had helped shove her over that edge. She was still on the fall down. There was no getting up, because there was no bottom. Powerful, rough hands under her shoulders, the world tilting and spinning, then that tattooed, snarling face in hers. Let him take her head between those massive hands and snap her neck. "Pathetic," he spat, releasing her. "Spineless and pathetic." For Nehemia, she had to try. Had to try. but when she reached in, toward the place in her chest where that monster dwelled, she found only cobwebs and ashes. Selena's head was still reeling, and dried blood now itched down the side of her face. She didn't bother to wipe it off, or to really care about the black eye that she was positive had blossomed during the miles they'd hiked from the temple ruins and into the forested foothills. But not back to Mistward. She was swaying on her feet when Rowan drew a sword and a dagger and stopped at the edge of a grassy plateau, speckled with small hills. Not hills. Barrows, the ancient tombs of lords and princes long dead, rolling to the other edge of trees. There were dozens, each marked with a stone threshold and sealed iron door. And through the murky vision, the pounding headache, the hair on the back of her neck rose. The grassy mounds seemed to breathe, to sleep. Iron doors, to keep the whites inside, locked with the treasure they'd stolen. They infiltrated the barrows and lurked there for eons, feeding on whatever unwitting fools dared seek the gold within. Rowan inclined his head toward the barrows.
I had planned to wait until you had some handle on your power, planned to make you come at night, when the barrow whites are really something to behold. But consider this a favor, as there are few that will dare come out in the day. Walk through the mounds. Face the whites and make it to the other side of the field, Aelin. And we can go to Doranel whenever you wish.
It was a trap. She knew that well enough. He had the gift of endless time and could play games that lasted centuries. Her impatience, her mortality, the fact that every heartbeat brought her closer to death, was being used against her. To face the whites. Rowan's weapons gleamed, close enough to grab. He shrugged those powerful shoulders as he said,
You can either wait to earn back your steel, or you can enter as you are now.
The flash of temper snapped her out of it long enough to say, My bare hands are weapon enough. He just gave a taunting grin and sauntered into the maze of hills. She trailed him closely, following him around each mound, knowing that if she fell too far behind, he'd leave her out of spite. Steady breathing and the yawns of awakening things arose beyond those iron doors. They were unadorned, bolted into the stone lintels with spikes and nails that were so old they probably predated Wendlin itself. Her footsteps crunched in the grass. Even the birds and insects did not utter a too loud sound here. The hills parted to reveal an inner circle of dead grass around the most crumbling barrow of all. Where the others were rounded, this one looked as if some ancient god had stepped on it. Its flattened top had been overrun with the gnarled roots of bushes. The three massive stones of the threshold were beaten, stained, and askew. The iron door was gone. There was only blackness within. Ageless, breathing blackness. Her heartbeat pounded in her ears as the darkness reached for her.
I leave you here, Rowan said.
He hadn't set one foot inside the circle, his boots just an inch shy of the dead grass. His smile turned feral.
I'll meet you on the other side of the field.
He expected her to bolt like a hare, and she wanted to. Gods, this place, that damned barrow only 100 yards away, made her want to run, and not stop until she found a place where the sun shone day and night. But if she did this, then she could go to Doranel tomorrow. And those whites waiting in the other half of the field. They couldn't be worse than what she'd already seen, and fought, and found dwelling in the world and inside of herself. So she inclined her head to Rowan and walked onto the dead field. Chapter 14. Each step toward the central mound had Selena's blood roaring. The darkness between the stained ancient stones grew, swirling. It was colder, too. Cold and dry. She wouldn't stop. Not with Rowan still watching. Not when she had so much to do. She didn't dare look too long toward the open doorway and the thing lurking beyond. A lingering shred of pride, stupid mortal pride, kept her from bolting through the rest of the field. Running, she remembered, only attracted some predators. So she kept her steps slow and called on every bit of training she'd had, even as the white slunk closer to the threshold, no more than a ripple of ravenous hunger encased in rags. Yet the white remained within its mound, even as she came near enough to drag into the barrow, as if it were hesitating. She was just passing the barrow when a pulsing, stale bit of air pushed against her ears. Maybe running was a good idea. If magic was the only weapon against whites, then her hands would be useless. Still, the white lingered beyond the threshold. The strange, dead air pushed against her ears again, a high-pitched ringing wending itself into her head. She hurried, grass crunching as she gathered every detail she could to wield against whatever assailant lurked nearby. Treetops swayed in the misty breeze on the other end of the field. It wasn't far. Selena passed the central mound, cracking her jaw against the ringing in her ears. Worse and worse with each step. Even the white cringed away. It hadn't been hesitating because of her, or Rowan. The circle of dead grass ended a few steps away. Just a few. Just a few, and then she could run from whatever it was that could make a white tremble in fear. And then she saw him. The man standing behind the barrow. Not a white. She glimpsed only a flash of pale skin, night-dark hair, unfathomable beauty, and an onyx torque around his strong column of a neck. And blackness, a wave of it slamming down on her. Not oblivion, but actual dark, as if he'd thrown a blanket over the two of them. The ground felt grassy, but she couldn't see it. Couldn't see anything. Not beyond, not to the side, not behind. There was only her and the swirling black. Selena crouched, biting down on a curse as she scanned the dark. Whatever he was, despite his shape, he wasn't mortal. In his perfection, in those depthless eyes, there was nothing human. Blood tickled her upper lip. A nosebleed. The pounding in her ears began to drown out her thoughts. Any plan, as if her body were repulsed by the very essence of whatever this thing was. The darkness remained, impenetrable, unending. Stop. Breathe. But someone was breathing behind her. Was it the man? Or something else? The breathing was louder, closer, and a chill air brushed her nose, her lips licking along her skin. Running, running was smarter than just waiting. She took several bounding steps that should have taken her toward the edge of the field, but nothing. Only endless black and the breathing thing that was closer now, reeking of dust and carrion and another scent. Something she hadn't smelled for a lifetime, but could never forget. Not when it had been coating that room like paint. Oh, gods. Breath on her neck, snaking up the shell of her ear. She whirled, drawing in what might very well be her last breath, and the world flashed bright. Not with clouds and dead grass, not with a Fey prince waiting nearby.
The room. This room.
The servant woman was screaming. Screaming like a tea kettle. There were still puddles just inside the shut windows. Windows Selena herself had sealed the night before, when they'd been flapping in the swift and sudden storm. She had thought the bed was wet because of the rain. She'd climbed in because the storm had made her hear such horrible things, made her feel like there was something wrong, like there was someone standing in the corner of her room. It was not rain soaking the bed in that elegantly rugged chamber at the country manor. It was not rain that had dried on her hands and skin and nightgown, and that smell. Not just blood, but something else. "This is not real," Selena said aloud, backing away from the bed on which she was standing like a ghost. "This is not real." But there were her parents, sprawled on the bed, their throats sliced ear to ear. There was her father, broad-shouldered and handsome, his skin already gray. There was her mother, her golden hair matted with blood. Her face, slaughtered like animals. The wounds were so vulgar, so gaping and deep, and her parents looked so... Selena vomited. She fell to her knees, her bladder loosening just before she vomited a second time. "This is not real. This is not real," she gasped, as a wet warmth soaked her pants. She couldn't breathe, couldn't breathe, couldn't... And then she was pushing to her feet, bolting away from that room, toward the wood-paneled walls, through them like a wraith herself, until... Another bedroom. Another body. Nehemia. Carved up, mutilated, violated and broken. The thing lurking behind her slid a hand over her waist, along her abdomen, pulling her back against its chest with a lover's gentleness. Panic surged, so strong that she slammed her elbow back and up, hitting what felt like flesh and bone. It hissed, releasing her. That was all she needed. She ran, treading through the illusion of her friend's blood and organs, and then... Watery sunlight, and dead grass, and a heavily armed silver-haired warrior whom she sprinted toward, not caring about the vomit on her clothes, her soiled pants, the gasping, shrieking noise coming out of her throat. She ran until she reached him and fell to the green grass, gripping it, shredding it, retching even though she had nothing left in her but a trickle of bile. She was screaming or sobbing or not making any sound at all. Then she felt the shift and the surge, a well opening beneath her stomach and filling with burning, relentless fire. No, no! Agony cleaved her in a pulse, her vision jumping between crystal clarity and the muted eyesight of mortals, her teeth aching as the fangs punched out and retracted, ebb and flow, immortal and mortal. Mortal and immortal, shifting as fast as a hummingbird's flapping wings. With each shift, the well deepened, that wildfire rising and falling and reaching up, up. She really did scream then, because her throat burned. Or maybe that was the magic coming out, at last unleashed. Magic. Selena awoke under the canopy of the forest. It was still daylight, and from the dirt on her shirt and pants and boots, it seemed like Rowan had dragged her here from the barrows. That was vomit on her shirt and pants. And then there was... She'd wet herself. Her face heated, but she shoved away the thoughts about why she had pissed herself, why she had hurled her guts up. And that last thought, about magic.
No discipline, no control, and no courage, came a growling voice.
Head throbbing, she found Rowan sitting on a rock, his muscular arms braced on his knees. A dagger hung from his left hand, as if he'd been idly tossing the damn thing in the air while she lay in her own filth.
You failed,
he said flatly.
You made it to the other side of the field, but I said to face the whites, not throw a magical tantrum.
I will kill you, she said,
the words raw and gasping.
How dare—
That was not a white, princess.
He flicked his attention toward the trees beyond her. She might have roared about using specifics to escape his bargain to bring her to Doranelle. But when his eyes met hers again, he seemed to say,
That thing should not have been there.
Then what in hell was it, you stupid bastard? She silently shot back. He clenched his jaw before he said aloud,
I don't know.
We've had skinwalkers on the prowl for weeks, roaming down from the hills to search for human pelts. But this was something different. I have never encountered its like, not in these lands or any other. Thanks to having to drag you away, I don't think I'll learn any time soon.
He gave her a pointed look at her current state.
It was gone when I circled back.
Tell me what happened.
I saw only darkness, and when you emerged, you were different.
She dared a look at herself again. Her skin was bone white, as if the little color she'd received lying on those rooftops in Verez had been leached away, and not only by fright and sickness.
No,
she said.
And you can go to hell.
Other lives might depend on it.
I want to go back to the fortress, she breathed.
She didn't want to know about the creatures or about the skinwalkers or about any of it. Each word was an effort.
Right. Now.
You're done when I say you're done.
You can kill me or torture me or throw me off a cliff, but I am done for today. In that darkness, I saw things that no one should be able to see. It dragged me through my memories, and not the decent ones. Is that enough for you?
He spat out a noise, but got to his feet and began walking. She staggered and stumbled, knees trembling, and kept moving after him, all the way into the halls of Mistward, where she angled her body so that none of the passing sentries or workers could see her soiled pants, the vomit. There was no hiding her face, though. She kept her attention on the prince until he opened a wooden door and a wall of steam hit her.
These are the female baths. Your room is a level up. Be in the kitchens at dawn tomorrow.
And then he left her again. Selena trudged into the steamy chamber, not caring who was in there as she shucked off her clothes, collapsed into one of the sunken stone tubs, and did not stir for a long, long while. Chapter 15. Kaol wasn't at all surprised that his father was 20 minutes late to their meeting. Nor was he surprised when his father strode into Kaol's office, slid into the chair opposite his desk, and offered no explanation for his tardiness. With calculated cool and distaste, he surveyed the office. No windows, a worn rug, an open trunk of discarded weapons that Kaol had never found the time to polish or send for repairs. At least it was organized. The few papers on his desk were stacked. His glass pens were in their proper holders. His suit of armor, which he rarely had occasion to wear, gleamed from its dummy in the corner. His father said at last,
This is what our illustrious king gives the captain of his guard.
Kaol shrugged, and his father studied the heavy oak desk. a desk he'd inherited from his predecessor, and one on which he and Selena had. He shut down the memory before it could boil his blood, and instead smiled at his father.
There was a larger office available in the glass edition, but I wanted to be accessible to my men.
It was the truth. He also hadn't wanted to be anywhere near the administrative wing of the castle, sharing a hallway with courtiers and councilmen.
A wise decision.
His father leaned back in the ancient wooden chair.
A leader's instincts.
Kaol pinned him with a long stare.
I'm to return to Aniel with you. I'm surprised you waste your breath on flattery. Is that so? From what I've seen, you have been making no move to prepare for this so-called return. You're not even looking for a replacement. Despite your low opinion of my position, it's one I take seriously. I won't have just anyone looking after this palace.
You haven't even told His Majesty that you're leaving. That pleasant, dead smile remained on his father's face.
When I begged for my leave next week, the king made no mention of you accompanying me. Rather than land you in hot water, boy, I held my tongue.
Kaol kept his face bland, neutral.
Again, I'm not leaving until I find a proper replacement. It's why I asked you to meet me. I need time.
It was true, partially at least. Just as he had for the past few nights, Kaol had dropped by Adian's party. Another tavern, even more expensive, even more packed. Adian wasn't there again. Somehow, everyone thought the general was there, and even the courtesan who'd left with him the first night said that the general had given her a gold coin. Without utilizing her services, and gone off to find more sparkling wine. Kaol had stood on the street corner where the courtesan said she'd left him, but found nothing. And wasn't it fascinating that no one really seemed to know exactly when the Bane would arrive, or where they were currently camped, only that they were on their way? Kaol was too busy during the day to track Adian down, and during the king's various meetings and luncheons, confronting the general was impossible. But tonight, he planned to arrive at the party early enough that he'd see if Adian even showed, and where he slipped off to. The sooner he could get something on Adian, the sooner he could settle all this nonsense and keep the king from looking too long in his direction before he turned in his resignation. He'd only called this meeting because of a thought that had awoken him in the middle of the night. A slightly insane, highly dangerous plan that would likely get him killed before it even accomplished anything. He'd skimmed through all those books Selena had found on magic, and found nothing at all about how he might help Dorian, and Selena, by freeing it. But Selena had once told him that the rebel group Archer and Nehemia had run claimed two things. One, that they knew where Aelin Galathinius was, and two, that they were close to finding a way to break the King of Otterland's mysterious power over the continent. The first one was a lie, of course. But if there was the slightest chance that these rebels knew how to free magic, he had to take it. He was already going out to trail Adian, and he'd seen all of Selena's notes about the rebel hideouts. So he had an idea of where they could be found. This would have to be dealt with carefully, and he still needed as much time as he could buy. His father's dead smile faded, and true steel, honed by decades of ruling Aniel, shone through. Rumor has it you consider yourself a man of honor, though I wonder what manner of man you truly are, if you do not honor your bargains.
I wonder.
His father made a good show of chewing on his bottom lip.
I wonder what your motive was, then, in sending your woman to Wendlin.
Kaol fought the urge to stiffen.
For the noble Captain Westfall, there would be no question that he truly wanted His Majesty's champion to dispatch our foreign enemies. Yet for the oathbreaker, the liar.
I am not breaking my vow to you,
Kaol said, meaning every word.
I intend to go to Anio. I will swear that in any temple before any god. But only when I've found a replacement.
You swore a month, his father growled.
You're to have me for the rest of my damned life. What is a month or two more to you?
His father's nostrils flared. What purpose, then, did his father have in wanting him to return so quickly? Kaol was about to ask, itching to make his father squirm a bit, when an envelope landed on his desk. It had been years, years and years, but he still remembered his mother's handwriting, still recalled the elegant way in which she drew his name.
What is this?
Your mother sent a letter to you. I suppose she's expressing her joy at your anticipated return. Kaol didn't touch the envelope.
Aren't you going to read it? I have nothing to say to her, and no interest in what she has to say to me.
Kaol lied. Another trap, another way to unnerve him. But he had so much to do here, so many things to learn and uncover. He'd honor his vow soon enough. His father snatched back the letter, tucking it into his tunic.
She will be most saddened to hear that.
And he knew his father, well aware of Kaol's lie, would tell his mother exactly what he'd said. For a heartbeat, his blood roared in his ears, the way it always had when he'd witnessed his father belittling his mother, reprimanding her, ignoring her. He took a steadying breath.
4 months, then I'll go. Set the date and it'll be done.
2 months.
3.
A slow smile.
I could go to the king right now and ask for your dismissal instead of waiting 3 months.
Kaol clenched his jaw.
Name your price, then.
Oh, there's no price. But I think I like the idea of you owing me a favor. That dead smile returned.
I like that idea very much. 2 months, boy.
They did not bother with goodbyes. Sorsha was called up to the Crown Prince's chambers, just as she was settling in to brew a calming tonic for an overworked kitchen girl. And though she tried not to seem too eager and pathetic, she found a way to very, very quickly dump the task on one of the lower-level apprentices and make the trek to the prince's tower. She'd never been here, but she knew where it was. All the healers did, just in case. The guards let her pass with hardly a nod, and by the time she'd ascended the spiral staircase, the door to his chambers was already open. A mess. His rooms were a mess of books and papers and discarded weapons. And there, sitting at a table with hardly a foot of space cleared for him, was Dorian, looking rather embarrassed, either at the mess or at his split lip. She managed to bow, even as that traitorous heat flooded her again, up her neck and across her face.
Your Highness summoned me.
A cleared throat.
Well, I think you can see what needs repairing.
Another injury to his hand. This one looked like it was from sparring, but the lip. Getting that close to him would be an effort of will. Hand first, then. Let that distract her. Anchor her. She set down her basket of supplies and lost herself in the work of readying ointments and bandages. His scented soap caressed her nose,
strong enough to suggest he'd just bathed, which was a horrible thing to think about as she stood beside his chair, because she was a professional healer, and imagining her patients naked was not a...
Aren't you going to ask what happened?
The prince said, peering up at her.
It's not my place to ask, and unless it's relevant to the injury, it's nothing I need to know.
It came out colder, harder than she meant, but it was true. Efficiently, she patched up his hand. The silence didn't bother her. She'd sometimes spent days in the catacombs without speaking to anyone. She'd been a quiet child before her parents had died, and after the massacre in the city square, she'd become even more so. It wasn't until she'd come to the castle that she found friends, found that she sometimes liked talking. Yet now, with him, well, it seemed that the prince didn't like silence, because he looked up at her again and said,
"Where are you from?"
Such a tricky question to answer, since the how and why of her journey to this castle were stained by the actions of his father.
"Fenharrow?"
she said, praying that would be the end of it. "Where in Fenharrow?" She almost cringed, but she had more self-control than that after 5 years of tending gruesome injuries and knowing that one flicker of disgust or fear on her face could shatter a patient's control.
"A small village in the south. Most people have never heard of it."
"Fenharrow is beautiful,"
he said.
"All that open land, stretching on forever."
She did not remember enough of it to recall whether she had loved the flat expanse of farmland, bordered on the west by mountains and on the east by sea.
"Did you always want to be a healer?"
"Yes," she said,
because she was entrusted to heal the heir to the empire and could show nothing but absolute certainty. A slash of a grin.
"Liar."
She didn't mean to, but she met his gaze, those sapphire eyes so bright in the late afternoon sun streaming through the small window.
"I did not mean any offense, your—"
"I'm prying."
He tested the bandages.
"I was trying to distract myself."
She nodded, because she had nothing to say and could never come up with anything clever anyway. She drew out her tin of disinfecting salve.
"For your lip, if you don't mind, Your Highness. I want to make sure there's no dirt or anything in the wound so it—"
"Sorsha."
She tried not to let it show. What it did to her to have him remember her name, or to hear him say it.
"Do what you need to do."
She bit her lip, a stupid, nervous habit, and nodded as she tilted his chin up so she could better see his mouth. His skin was so warm. She touched the wound and he hissed, his breath caressing her fingers, but didn't pull back or reprimand or strike her as some of the other courtiers did. She applied the salve to his lip as quickly as she could. Gods, his lips were soft. She hadn't known he was the prince the day she first saw him, striding through the gardens, the captain in tow. They were barely into their teenage years, and she was an apprentice in hand-me-down clothes. But for a moment, he'd looked at her and smiled. He'd seen her when no one else had for years. So she found excuses to be in the upper levels of the castle. But she'd wept the next month when she spied him again. And two apprentices had whispered about how handsome the prince was. Dorian, heir to the throne. It had been secret and stupid, this infatuation with him. Because when she finally encountered him again, years later, while helping Amethy with a patient, he did not look at her. She had become invisible, like many of the healers. Invisible, just as she had wanted.
"Sorsha?"
Her horror achieved new depths as she realized she'd been staring at his mouth, fingers still in her tin of salve.
"I'm sorry," she said.
Wondering whether she should throw herself from the tower and end her humiliation.
"It's been a long day."
That wasn't a lie. She was acting like a fool. She'd been with a man before. One of the guards. Just once, and long enough to know she wasn't particularly interested in letting another one touch her anytime soon. But standing so close, his legs brushing the skirt of her brown homespun dress, "Why didn't you tell anyone?" he asked quietly.
"About me and my friends."
She backed away a step, but held his stare, even though training and instinct told her to avert her eyes.
"You were never cruel to the healers. To anyone. I like to think that the world needs..."
Saying that was too much, because the world was his father's world. "Needs better people," he finished for her, standing. "And you think my father would have used your knowledge of our comings and goings against us?" So he knew that Amethy reported anything unusual. Amethy had told Sorsha to do the same, if she knew what was good for her.
"I don't mean to imply that His Majesty would..."
"Does your village still exist? Are your parents still alive?" Even years later, she couldn't keep the pain from her voice as she said,
"No, it was burned. And no, they brought me to Rifthold and were killed in the city's immigrant perch."
A shadow of grief and horror in his eyes.
"So why would you ever come here? Work here?"
She gathered her supplies.
"Because I had nowhere else to go."
Agony flickered on his face.
"Your Highness, have I..."
But he was staring as if he understood. And saw her.
"I'm sorry."
"It wasn't your decision, or your soldiers who rounded up my parents."
He only looked at her for a long moment before thanking her. A polite dismissal. And she wished, as she left that cluttered tower, that she'd never opened her mouth, because perhaps he'd never call on her again for the sheer awkwardness of it. She wouldn't lose her position, because he wasn't that cruel. But if he refused her services, then it might lead to questions. So Sorsha resolved, as she lay that night in her little cot, to find a way to apologize, or maybe find excuses to keep the prince from seeing her again. Tomorrow. She'd figure it out tomorrow. The following day, she didn't expect the messenger who arrived after breakfast, asking for the name of her village. And when she hesitated, he said that the crown prince wanted to know. Wanted to know, so he could have it added to his personal map of the continent. Chapter 16. Of all the spaces in the Omega, the mess hall was by far the most dangerous. The three Iron Teeth clans had been divided into rotating shifts that kept them mostly separated. Training with the Wyverns, training in the weapons room, and training in mortal warfare. It was smart to separate them, Manon supposed, since tensions were high, and would continue to run high until the Wyverns were selected. Everyone wanted a bull. Though Manon fully expected to get one, perhaps even Titus, it didn't keep her from wanting to punch out the teeth of anyone who even whispered about coveting a bull of her own. There were only a few overlapping minutes between their 3-hour rotations, and the coven leaders did their best to keep them from running into each other. At least Manon did. Her temper was on a tight leash these days, and one more sneer from the Yellowlegs' heir was likely to end in bloodshed. The same could be said of her 13, two of whom, the green-eyed twins Faelene and Fallon, more demon than witch,
had gotten into a brawl with some Yellowlegs idiots, unsurprisingly. She'd punished them just as she'd punished Asterin, 3 blows each, public and humiliating. But like clockwork, fights still broke out between other covens when they were in close quarters, which was what made the mess hall so deadly. The 2 daily meals were the only time they all shared together, and while they kept to their own tables, the tension was so thick Manon could slice it with her blade. Manon stood in line for her bowl of slop. That was the best name she could give the doughy goop the mess hall served, flanked by Asterin, with the last of the blue blood witches in the line ahead of her. Somehow, the blue bloods were always first. First in line for food, first to ride the wyverns, the 13 had yet to get airborne, and likely to get first pick of the beasts. A growl rumbled deep in her throat, but Manon pushed her tray along the table, watching the pale-faced server heap a grayish-white ball of food into the bowl of the blue blood in front of her. She didn't bother to note the details of his features as the thick vein in his throat pulsed. Witches didn't need blood to survive, but humans didn't need wine either. The blue bloods were picky about whose blood they drank. Virgins, young men, pretty girls. But the blackbeaks didn't particularly care one way or another. The man's ladle began shaking, tip-tapping along the side of the cauldron.
"Rules are rules," drawled a voice to her left.
Asterin let out a warning snarl, and Manon didn't have to look to know that the Yellowleg's heir, Iskra, lurked there.
"No eating the rabble,"
the dark-haired witch added, shoving her bowl in front of the man, cutting the line. Manon took in the iron nails and teeth, the calloused hand so blatantly making a show of dominance. "Ah, I was wondering why no one's bothered to eat you," Manon said. Iskra shouldered her way farther in front of Manon. Manon could feel the eyes in the room shifting toward them, but she reined in her temper, allowing the disrespect. Mess hall posturing meant nothing.
"I hear your 13 are taking to the air today,"
said the Yellowleg's heir, as Manon received her own ration. "What business is it of yours?" Iskra shrugged her toned shoulders.
"They say you were once the best flyer in all 3 clans. It would be a shame if it were just more gossip."
It was true. She'd earned her spot as coven leader as much as she'd inherited it. Iskra went on, sliding her plate along to the next server, who spooned some pale root vegetable onto her slop.
"There's talk of skipping our training rotation, so we can see the legendary 13 take to the skies for the first time in a decade."
Manon clicked her tongue in pretend thought. "I also heard there's talk that the Yellowlegs need all the help they can get in the sparring room. But I suppose any army needs its supply drivers." A low laugh from Asterin, and Iskra's brown eyes flashed. They reached the end of the serving table, where Iskra faced Manon. With their trays in hand, neither could reach for the blades at their sides. The room had gone silent. Even the high table at which the 3 matrons sat. Manon's gums stung, as her iron teeth shot from their slits and snapped down. She said quietly, but loud enough for everyone to hear, "Anytime you need a lesson in combat, Iskra, you just let me know. I'd be happy to teach you a few things about soldiering." Before the heir could reply, Manon stalked across the room. Asterin gave Iskra a mocking bow of the head, followed by identical gestures from the rest of her 13. But Iskra remained staring at Manon, simmering. Manon plunked down at her table to find her grandmother smiling faintly. And when all of Manon's 12 sentinels were seated around her, 13 from now until the darkness embraced them, Manon allowed herself a smile, too. They were going to fly today.
As if the open cliff face weren't enough to make the two gathered blackbeak covens shift on their feet. The 26 tethered wyverns in a tight space, none of them that docile, made even Manon twitchy. But she showed no fear as she approached the wyvern at the center. Two lines of 13 stood chained and ready. The 13 took the first. The other coven took the one behind. Manon's new riding gear was heavy and awkward. Leather and fur, capped with steel shoulder guards and leather wrist braces. More than she was used to wearing, especially with her red cloak. They'd already practiced saddling the mounts for 2 days, though they'd usually have handlers around to do it for them. Manon's mount for the day, a small female, was lying on her belly, low enough that Manon easily climbed her hind leg and hauled herself into the saddle at the spot where the long neck met the massive shoulders. A man approached to adjust the stirrups, but Manon leaned to do it herself. Breakfast had been bad enough. Coming close to a human throat now would only tempt her further. The wyvern shifted, its body warm against her cold legs, and Manon tightened her gloved grip on the reins. Down the line, her sentinels mounted their beasts. Asterin was ready, of course, her cousin's gold hair tightly braided back, her fur collar ruffling in the biting wind from the open drop ahead of them. She flashed Manon a grin, her dark, gold-flecked eyes bright. Not a trace of fear, just the thrill. The beasts knew what to do, the handlers had said. They knew how to make the crossing on instinct alone. That's what they called the sheer plunge between the two mountain peaks, the final test for a rider and mount. If the wyverns couldn't make it, they'd splatter on the rocks far below, with their riders. There was movement on the viewing platforms on either side, and the Yellowlegs' heirs' coven swaggered in, all of them smiling, none more broadly than Iskra.
"Bitch,"
Asterin murmured, as if it weren't bad enough that Mother Blackbeak stood on the opposite viewing platform, flanked by the other two high witches. Manon lifted her chin and looked to the drop ahead.
"Just like we practiced," the overseer said, climbing from the open-faced pit to the viewing platform where the three matrons stood. "Hard kick in the side sends him off. Let him navigate the crossing. Best advice is to hold on like hell and enjoy the ride."
A few nervous laughs from the coven behind her, but the 13 remained silent, waiting, just as they would faced with any army, before any battle. Manon blinked, the muscles behind her golden eyes pulling down the clear film that would shield her vision from the wind. Manon allowed herself a moment to adjust to the thickness of the extra lid. Without it, they'd fly like mortals, squinting and streaming tears all over the place.
"Ready at your command, lady,"
the man called to her. Manon studied the open gap ahead, the bridge barely visible above, the gray skies and mist. She looked down the line, into each of the six faces on either side. Then she turned ahead, to the drop and the world waiting beyond.
"We are the 13, from now until the darkness claims us."
She said it quietly, but knew all could hear her.
"Let's remind them why."
Manon kicked her mount into action. Three galloping, thunderous steps beneath her, surging forward, 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 a leap into freezing air, the clouds and the bridge and the snow all around, and then the drop. Her stomach shot right into her throat as the wyvern arced and angled down, wings tucked in tight. As she'd been instructed, Manon rose into a crouch over the neck, keeping her face close to the leathery skin, the wind screaming in her face. The air rippled behind her, her 13 mere feet away,
falling as one, past rock and snow, shooting for the earth. Manon gritted her teeth. The blur of stone, the kiss of mist, her hair ripping out of her braid, waving like a white banner above her. The mist parted, and darkness embraced her. There was the gap floor, so close, and Manon held on to the saddle, to the reins, to conscious thought, as massive wings spread and the world tilted, and the body beneath her flipped up, up, riding the wind's current in a sheer climb along the side of the northern fang. There were triumphant howls from below, from above, and the wyvern kept climbing, swifter than Manon had ever flown on her broom, past the bridge and up into the open sky. That fast, Manon was back in the skies. The cloudless, endless, eternal sky held them, as Asterin, and then Sorrel and Vesta flanked her, then the rest of the 13. And Manon schooled her face into cool victory. To her right, Asterin was beaming, her iron teeth shining like silver. To her left, red-haired Vesta was just shaking her head, gaping at the mountains below. Sorrel was as stone-faced as Manon, but her black eyes danced. The 13 were airborne again. The world spread beneath them, and ahead, far to the west, was the home they would someday reclaim. But now, the wind caressed and sang to her, telling her of its currents, more an instinct than a magical gift. An instinct that had made her the best flyer in all three clans. "What now?" Asterin called. And although she'd never seen any of her 13 cry, Manon could have sworn there were tears shining in the corners of her cousin's eyes. "I say, we test them out," Manon said, keeping that wild exuberance locked up tight in her chest, and reined her mount toward where the first canyon run awaited them. The whoops and cackles of her 13, as they rode the current, were finer than any mortal music. Manon stood at attention in her grandmother's small room, staring at the far stone wall until she was spoken to. Mother Blackbeak sat at the wooden desk, her back to Manon as she pored over some document or letter. "You did well today, Manon," her grandmother said at last. Manon touched two fingers to her brow, though her grandmother still studied the papers. Manon hadn't needed to be told by the overseer that it was the best crossing he had witnessed to date. She'd taken one look at the empty platform where the Yellowlegs' coven had been, and known they'd left as soon as Manon didn't splatter on the ground. "Your 13 and all the Blackbeak covens did well," her grandmother went on. "Your work in keeping them disciplined these years is commendable." Manon's chest swelled, but she said, "It's my honor to serve you, grandmother." Her grandmother scribbled something down. "I want you and the 13 to be wing leader. I want you leading all the clans." The witch twisted to look at Manon, her face unreadable. "There are to be war games in a few months to decide the ranks. I don't care how you do it, but I expect to crown you victor." Manon didn't need to ask why. Her grandmother's eyes fell on Manon's red cloak as she smiled faintly. "We don't yet know who our enemies will be. But once we are done with the King's War and reclaim the Wastes, it will not be a Blue Blood or Yellow Legs sitting on the Iron Teeth throne. Understand? Become wing leader, command the Iron Teeth armies, and keep control of those armies once the matrons eventually turned on one another." Manon nodded. It would be done. "I suspect the other matrons will give similar orders to their heirs," Make sure your second keeps close to you. Asterin was already outside, guarding the door, but Manon said, I can look after myself. Her grandmother hissed. Baba Yellowlegs was 700 years old. She tore down the walls of the Kraken capital with her bare hands. And yet someone slipped into her wagon and murdered her. Even if you live to be 1,000, you'll be lucky to be half the witch she was. Manon kept her chin high. Watch your back. I will not be pleased if I have to find myself another heir. Manon bowed her head. As you will it, grandmother. Chapter 17. Selena awoke, freezing and groaning from a relentless headache. That, she knew, was from hitting her head on the temple stones. She hissed as she sat up. And every inch of her body, from her ears to her toes to her teeth, gave a collective burst of pain. It felt as if she'd been pummeled by 1,000 iron fists and left to rot in the cold. That was from the uncontrolled shifting she'd done yesterday. The gods knew how many times she'd shuddered between one form and the other. From the tenderness of her muscles, it had to have been dozens. But she hadn't lost control of the magic, she reminded herself as she rose, gripping the chipped bedpost. She pulled the pale robe tighter around her as she shuffled for the dresser and basin. After the bath, she realized she had nothing to change into and had stolen one of the many robes, leaving her reeking clothes heaped by the door. She'd barely made it to her room before she collapsed on the bed, pulled the scrap of blanket over her, and slept. And slept, and slept. She didn't feel like talking with anyone, and no one came for her anyway. Selena braced her hands on the dresser and grimaced at her reflection. She looked like shit, felt like shit, even more grim and gaunt than yesterday. She picked up the tin of salve Rowan had given her, but then decided he should see what he'd done. And she'd looked worse. 2 years ago, when Arobin had beaten her to a bloody pulp for disobeying his orders. This was nothing compared to how mangled she'd been then. She opened the door to find that someone had left clothes, the same as yesterday, but fresh. Her boots had been cleaned of mud and dust. Either Rowan had left them, or someone else had noticed her filthy clothing. Gods. She'd soiled herself in front of him. She didn't let herself wallow in the humiliation as she dressed and went to the kitchens, the halls dark in the moments before dawn. Already, Luca was prattling about the fighting knife a sentry had loaned him for his training, and on and on and on. Apparently, she had underestimated how horrific her face was, because Luca stopped his chattering mid-sentence to swear. Whirling, Emrys took one look at her and dropped his earthenware bowl before the hearth. Great mother and all her children. Selena went to the heap of garlic cloves on the work table and picked up a knife. It looks worse than it feels. A lie. Her head was still pounding from the cut on her brow, and her eye was deeply bruised beneath. I've got some salve in my room. Luca started from where he was already washing dishes. But she gave him a long look. She began peeling the cloves, her fingers instantly sticky. They were still staring. So she flatly said, It's none of your business. Emrys left his shattered bowl on the hearthstones and hobbled over, anger dancing in those bright, clever eyes. It's my business when you come into my kitchen. I've been through worse, she said. Luca said, What do you mean? He eyed her mangled hands, her black eye, and the ring of scars around her neck, courtesy of Baba Yellowlegs. She silently invited him to do the calculations. A life in Otterlin with Fae blood. A life in Otterlin as a woman. His face paled. After a long moment, Emrys said,
"Leave it alone, Luca,"
and stooped to pick up the fragments of the bowl. Selena went back to the garlic. Luca markedly quieter as he worked. Breakfast was made and sent upstairs in the same chaotic rush as yesterday. But a few more demi-fae noticed her today. She either ignored them or stared them down, marking their faces. Many had pointed ears, but most seemed human. Some wore civilian clothing, tunics and simple gowns, while the sentries wore light leather armor and heavy gray cloaks with an array of weapons, many the worse for wear. The warriors looked her way the most, men and women both, wariness and curiosity mingling. She was busy wiping down a copper pot when someone let out a low, appreciative whistle in her direction. "Now that is one of the most glorious black eyes I've ever beheld." A tall old man, handsome despite being around Emrys's age, strode through the kitchen, empty platter in his hands.
"You leave her be too, Malachi,"
Emrys said from the hearth. His husband, mate. The old man gave a dashing grin and set down the platter on the counter near Selena. "Rowan doesn't pull punches, does he?" His gray hair was cropped short enough to reveal his pointed ears, but his face was ruggedly human. "And it looks like you don't bother using a healing salve." She held his gaze but gave no reply. Malachi's grin faded.
"My mate works too much as it is. You don't add to that burden, understand?"
Emrys growled his name, but Selena shrugged.
"I don't want to bother with any of you."
Malachi caught the unspoken warning in her words,
"So don't try to bother with me,"
and gave her a curt nod. She heard, more than saw, him stride to Emrys and kiss him, then the rumble of some murmured, stern words, and then his steady footsteps as he walked out again.
"Even the demi-fae warrior males push overprotective to a whole new level,"
Emrys said, the words laced with forced lightness. "It's in our blood," Luca said, lifting his chin. "It is our duty, honor, and life's mission to make sure our families are cared for, especially our mates."
"And it makes you a thorn in our side," Emrys clucked. "Possessive territorial beasts."
The old man strode to the sink, setting down the cool kettle for Selena to wash.
"My mate means well, lass, but you're a stranger, and from Otterlin, and you're training with someone none of us quite understand."
Selena dumped the kettle in the sink.
"I don't care," she said, and meant it.
Training was horrible that day. Not just because Rowan asked if she was going to vomit or piss herself again, but also because for hours, hours, he made her sit amongst the temple ruins on the ridge, battered by the misty wind. He wanted her to shift. That was his only command. She demanded to know why he couldn't teach her the magic without shifting, and he gave her the same answer again and again. No shift, no magic lessons. But after yesterday, nothing short of him taking his long dagger and cutting her ears into points would get her to change forms. She tried once, when he stalked into the woods for some privacy. She tugged and yanked and pulled at whatever lay deep inside her, but got nothing. No flash of light or searing pain. So they sat on the mountainside, Selena frozen to the bone. At least she didn't lose control again, no matter what insults he threw her way, either aloud or through one of their silent, vicious conversations. She asked him why he wasn't pursuing the creature that had been in the Barrow Whites field, and he merely said that he was looking into it, and the rest was none of her concern. Thunderclouds clustered during the late afternoon. Rowan forced her to sit through the storm until her teeth were clattering in her skull, and her blood was thick with ice. And then they finally made the trek to the fortress. He ditched her by the baths again, eyes glimmering with an unspoken promise that tomorrow would be worse. When she finally emerged, there were dry clothes in her room, folded and placed with such care that she was starting to wonder whether she didn't have some invisible servant shadowing her. There was no way in hell an immortal like Rowan would have bothered to do that for a human. She debated staying in her rooms for the rest of the night, especially as rain lashed at her window, lightning illuminating the trees beyond. But her stomach gurgled. She was lightheaded again, and knew she'd been eating like an idiot. With her black eye, the best thing to do was eat, even if it meant going to the kitchens. She waited until she thought everyone had gone upstairs. There were always leftovers after breakfast. There had to be some at dinner. Gods, she was bone-tired, and ached even worse than she had this morning. She heard the voices long before she entered the kitchen, and almost turned back, but no one had spoken to her at breakfast save Malachi. Surely everyone would ignore her now, too. She'd estimated a good number of people in the kitchen, but was still a bit surprised by how packed it was. Chairs and cushions had been dragged in, all facing the hearth, before which Emrys and Malachi sat, chatting with those gathered. There was food on every surface, as if dinner had been held in here. Keeping to the shadows atop the stairs, she observed them. The dining hall was spacious, if a bit cold. Why gather around the kitchen hearth? She didn't particularly care, not when she saw the food. She slipped in through the gathered crowd with practiced stealth and ease, filling up a plate with roast chicken, potatoes, gods, she was already sick of potatoes, and hot bread. Everyone was still chatting. Those who didn't have seats were standing against the counters or walls, laughing and sipping from their mugs of ale. The upper half of the kitchen door was open to let out the heat from all the bodies, the sound of rain filling the room like a drum. She caught a glimmer of movement outside, but when she looked, there was nothing there. Selena was about to slip back up the stairs when Malachi clapped his hands and everyone stopped talking. Selena paused again in the shadows of the stairwell. Smiles spread, and people settled in. Seated on the floor in front of Emrys's chair was Luca, a pretty young woman pressed into his side, his arm casually draped around her shoulders. Casually, but with enough of a grip to tell every other male in the room that she was his. Selena rolled her eyes, not at all surprised. Still, she caught the look Luca gave the girl, the mischief in his eyes that sent a pang of jealousy right through her. She'd looked at Kaol with that same expression. But their relationship had never been as unburdened, and even if she hadn't ended things, it never would have been like that. The ring on her finger became a weight. Lightning flashed, revealing the grass and forest beyond. Seconds later, thunder shook the stones, triggering a few shrieks and laughs. Emrys cleared his throat, and every eye snapped to his lined face. The ancient hearth illuminated his silver hair, casting shadows throughout the room. "Long ago," Emrys began, his voice weaving between the drumming rain and grumbling thunder and crackling fire, "when there was no mortal king on Wendland's throne, the Faeries still walked among us. Some were good and fair, some were prone to little mischiefs, and some were fouler and darker than the blackest night." Selena swallowed. These were words that had been spoken in front of hearths for thousands of years, spoken in kitchens like this one. Tradition.
It was those wicked fairies,
Emrys went on, the words resonating in every crack and crevice,
that you always had to watch for on the ancient roads, or in the woods, or on nights like this, when you can hear the wind moaning your name.
Oh, not that one, Luca groaned, but it wasn't heartfelt. Some of the others laughed, a bit nervously even. Someone else protested.
I won't sleep for a week.
Selena leaned against the stone wall, shoveling food down her throat as the old man wove his tale. The hair on her neck stood on end for the duration of it, and she could see every horrific moment of the story as clearly as if she had lived it. As Emrys finished his tale, thunder boomed, and even Selena flinched, almost upsetting her empty plate. There were some wary laughs, some taunts and gentle pushes. Selena frowned. If she'd heard this story, with the wretched creatures who delighted in skin-sewing and bone-crunching and lightning-crisping, before traveling here with Rowan, she never would have followed him. Not in a million years. Rowan hadn't lit a single fire on the journey here. Hadn't wanted to attract attention. From these sorts of creatures? He hadn't known what that thing was the day before in the barrows. And if an immortal didn't know... She used breathing exercises to calm her pounding heart. Still, she'd be lucky if she slept tonight. Though everyone else seemed to be waiting for the next story, Selena stood. As she turned to leave, she looked again to that half-open kitchen door, just to make sure there was nothing lurking outside. But it was not some fell creature who waited in the rain. A large white-tailed hawk was perched in the shadows. It sat absolutely still. But the hawk's eyes, there was something strange about them. She'd seen that hawk before. It had watched her for days as she'd lazed on that rooftop in Varez, watched her drink and steal and doze and brawl. At least she now knew what Rowan's animal form was. What she didn't know was why he bothered to listen to these stories.
Elentia.
Emrys was extending a hand from where he sat before the hearth.
Would you perhaps share a story from your lands? We'd love to hear a tale, if you'd do us the honor.
Selena kept her eyes on the old man, as everyone turned to where she stood in the shadows. Not one of them offered a word of encouragement, save for Luca, who said, "Tell us!" But she had no right to tell those stories as if they were her own. And she could not remember them correctly, not as they had been told at her bedside. She clamped down on the thought as hard as she could, shoving it back long enough to calmly say, "No, thank you," and walk away. No one came after her. She didn't give a damn what Rowan made of the whole thing. The whispers died with each step, and it wasn't until she'd shut the door to her freezing room and slid into bed that she loosed a sigh. The rain stopped, the clouds cleared on a brisk wind, and through the window, a patch of stars flickered above the tree line. She had no stories to tell. All the legends of Terrasen were lost to her, and only fragments were strewn through her memories like rubble. She pulled her scrap of blanket higher and draped an arm over her eyes, shutting out the ever-watching stars. Chapter 18. Mercifully, Dorian wasn't forced to entertain Adian again, and saw little of him outside of state dinners and meetings, where the general pretended he didn't exist. He saw little of Kaol, too, which was a relief, given how awkward their conversations had been of late. but he'd begun to spar with the guards in the mornings. It was about as fun as laying on a bed of hot nails, but at least it gave him something to do with the restless, anxious energy that hounded him day and night. Not to mention, all those cuts and scrapes and sprains gave him an excuse to go to the healer's catacombs. Sorsha, it seemed, had caught on to his training schedule, and her door was always open when he arrived. He hadn't been able to stop thinking about what she'd said in his room, or wondering why someone who had lost everything would dedicate her life to helping the family of the man who had taken it all away. And when she'd said, "Because I had nowhere else to go," for a second, it hadn't been Sorsha but Selena, broken with grief and loss and rage, coming to his room because there was no one else to turn to. He'd never known what that was like, that loss. But Sorsha's kindness to him, which he'd repaid so foully until now, hit him like a stone to the head. Dorian entered her workroom, and Sorsha looked up from the table and smiled, broadly and prettily, and, well, wasn't that exactly the reason he found excuses to come here every day? He held up his wrist, already stiff and throbbing.
"Landed on it badly,"
he said by way of greeting. She came around the table, giving him enough time to admire the long lines of her figure in her simple gown. She moved like water, he thought, and often caught himself marveling at the way she used her hands. "There's not much I can do for that," she said after examining his wrist. "But I have a tonic for the pain, only to subdue it, and I can put your arm in a sling if—"
"Gods, no. No sling. I'll never hear the end of it from the guards."
Her eyes twinkled, just a bit, in that way they did when she was amused and tried hard not to be. But if there was no sling, then he had no excuse to be here. And even though he had an inane council meeting in an hour and still needed to bathe, he stood.
"What are you working on?"
She took a careful step back from him. She always did that, to keep the wall up. "Well, I have a few tonics and salves to make for some of the servants and guards today, to replenish their stocks." He knew he shouldn't, but he moved to peer over her narrow shoulder at the work table, at the bowls and vials and beakers. She made a small noise in her throat, and he swallowed his smile as he leaned a bit closer. "This is normally a task for apprentices, but they were so busy today that I offered to take some of their workload." She usually talked like this when she was nervous, which Dorian had noticed with some satisfaction, was when he came near. And not in a bad way. If he'd sensed that she was truly uncomfortable, he'd have kept his distance. This was more flustered. He liked flustered. "But," she went on, trying to sidestep away, "I'll make your tonic right now, Your Highness." He gave her the space she needed as she hurried about the table with graceful efficiency, measuring powders and crushing dried leaves, so steady and self-assured. He realized he'd been staring when she spoke again. "Your friend, the King's Champion, is she well?" Her mission to Wendland was fairly secret, but he could get around that.
"She's off on my father's errand for the next few months. I certainly hope she's well, though I have no doubt she can care for herself."
"And her hound? She's well?"
"Fleetfoot? Oh, she's fine. Her legs healed beautifully."
The hound now slept in his bed, of course, and bullied him for scraps and treats to no end. But it was nice to have some peace of his friend while she was gone.
"Thanks to you."
A nod. And silence fell as she measured and then poured some green-looking liquid. He sincerely hoped he wasn't going to drink that. "They said, Sorsha kept her spectacular eyes down. They said there was some wild animal roaming the halls a few months ago. That's what killed all those people before Yulmas. I never heard whether they caught it, but then... Your friend's dog looked like she'd been attacked. Dorian willed himself to keep still. She'd truly put some things together then, and hadn't told anyone.
Ask it, Sorsha.
Her throat bobbed, and her hands shook a little, enough that he wanted to reach out and cover them. But he couldn't move. Not until she spoke. What was it? She breathed.
Do you want the answer that will keep you asleep at night? Or the one that might ensure you never sleep again?
She lifted her gaze to him, and he knew she wanted the truth. So he loosed a breath and said,
It was two different creatures. My father's champion dealt with the first. She didn't even tell the captain and me until we faced the second.
He could still hear that creature's roar in the tunnel, still see it squaring off against Kaol. Still had nightmares about it.
The rest is a bit of a mystery.
It wasn't a lie. There was still so much he didn't know, and didn't want to learn.
Would His Majesty punish you for it?
A quiet, dangerous question.
Yes.
His blood chilled at the thought. Because if he knew, if his father learned Selena had somehow opened a portal... Dorian couldn't stop the ice spreading through him. Sorsha rubbed her arms and glanced at the fire. It was still burning high, but... Shit. He had to go. Now. Sorsha said,
He'd kill her, wouldn't he? That's why you said nothing.
Dorian slowly started backing out, fighting against the panicked, wild thing inside of him. He couldn't stop the rising ice, didn't even know where it was coming from. But he kept seeing that creature in the tunnels, kept hearing Fleetfoot's pained bark, seeing Kaol choose to sacrifice himself so they could get away. Sorsha stroked the length of her dark braid.
And he'd probably kill the captain, too.
His magic erupted. After Sorsha had been forced to wait in the cramped office for 20 minutes, Amethy finally paraded in, her tight bun making her harsh face even more severe. Sorsha, she said, sitting down at her desk and frowning. What am I to do with you? What example does this set for the apprentices? Sorsha kept her head down. She knew she'd been kept waiting in order to make her fret over what she'd done, accidentally knocking over her entire work table and destroying not only countless hours and days of work, but also a good number of expensive tools and containers.
I slipped. I spilled some oil and forgot to wipe it up.
Amethy clicked her tongue. Cleanliness, Sorsha, is one of our most important assets. If you cannot keep your own workroom clean, how can you be trusted to care for our patients? For His Highness, who was there to witness your latest bout of unprofessionalism. I've taken the liberty of apologizing in person and offered to oversee his future care, but... Amethy's eyes narrowed. He said he would pay for the repair costs and would still like you to serve him. Sorsha's face warmed. It had happened so quickly. As the blast of ice and wind and something else surged toward her, Sorsha's scream had been cut off by the door slamming shut. That had probably saved their lives. But all she could think of was getting out of the way. So she'd crouched beneath her table, hands over her head, and prayed. She might have dismissed it as a draft, might have felt foolish, if the prince's eyes hadn't seemed to glow in that moment before the wind and cold, had the glasses on the table not all shattered, Had ice not coated the floor? Had he not just stayed there untouched? It wasn't possible. The prince. There was a choking, awful sound, and then Dorian was on his knees, peering under the work table.
Sorsha.
Sorsha. She'd gaped at him, unable to find the words. Amethy drummed her long, bony fingers on the wooden desk.
Forgive me for being indelicate, she said.
But Sorsha knew the woman didn't care one bit about manners.
But I'll also remind you that interacting with our patients outside of our duties is prohibited.
There could be no other reason for Prince Dorian to prefer Sorsha's services over Amethy's, of course. Sorsha kept her eyes on her clenched hands in her lap, still flecked with cuts from some of the small shards of glass.
You needn't worry about that, Amethy.
Good. I'd hate to see your position compromised.
His Highness has a reputation with women.
A little smug smile.
And there are many beautiful ladies at this court. And you are not one of them.
Sorsha nodded and took the insult, as she always did and had always done. That was how she survived, how she had remained invisible all these years. It was what she'd promised the prince in the minutes after his explosion, when her shaking ceased, and she'd seen him. Not the magic, but the panic in his eyes, the fear and pain. He wasn't an enemy using forbidden powers, but a young man in need of help. Her help. She could not turn away from it. From him. Could not tell anyone what she'd witnessed. It was what she would have done for anyone else. In the cool, calm voice that she reserved for her most grievously injured patients, she had said to the prince,
I'm not going to tell anyone. But right now, you are going to help me knock this table over. And then you are going to help me clean this up.
He'd just stared at her. She stood, noting the hair-thin slices on her hands that had already started stinging.
I am not going to tell anyone, she said again, grabbing one corner of the table.
Wordlessly, he went to the other end and helped her ease the table onto its side, the remaining glass and ceramic jars tumbling to the ground. For all the world, it looked like an accident. And Sorsha went to the corner to grab the broom.
When I open this door, she had said to him,
still quiet and calm and not quite herself,
we will pretend. But after today, after this.
Dorian stood rigid, as if he were waiting for the blow to fall.
After this, she said, if you are all right with it, we will try to find ways to keep this from happening. Perhaps there's some tonic to suppress it.
His face was still pale.
I'm sorry,
he breathed. And she knew he meant it. She went to the door and gave him a grim smile.
I will start researching tonight. If I find anything, I'll let you know. And perhaps, not now, but later. If your Highness has the inclination, you could tell me a bit about how this is possible. It might help me somehow.
She didn't give him time to say yes, but instead opened the door, walked back to the mess, and said a little louder than usual.
I am truly sorry, your Highness. There was something on the floor, and I slipped, and...
From there, it had been easy. The snooping healers had arrived to see what the commotion was about, and one of them had scuttled off to Amethy. The prince had left, and Sorsha had been ordered to wait here. Amethy braced her forearms on the desk.
His Highness was extraordinarily generous, Sorsha. Let it be a lesson for you. You're lucky you didn't injure yourself further. I'll make an offering to Silba today.
Sorsha lied, quiet and small, and left. Kaol pressed himself into the darkened alcove of a building, holding his breath as Adian approached the cloaked figure in the alley. Of all the places he'd expected Adian to go when he slipped out of his party at the tavern, the slums were not one of them. Adian had made a spectacular show of playing the generous wild host, buying drinks, saluting his guests, ensuring everyone saw him doing something. And just when no one was looking, Adian had walked right out the front, as if he were too lazy to go to the privy in the back. A staggering drunk, arrogant and careless and haughty. Kaol had almost bought it. Almost. Then Adian had gotten a block away, thrown his hood over his head, and prowled into the night, stone-cold sober. He'd trailed from the shadows as Adian left the wealthier district and strolled into the slums, taking alleys and crooked streets. He could have passed for a wealthy man seeking another sort of woman, until he'd stopped outside this building, and that cloaked figure with the twin blades approached him. Kaol couldn't hear the words between Adian and the stranger, but he could read the tension in their bodies well enough. After a moment, Adian followed the newcomer, though not before he thoroughly scanned the alley, the rooftops, the shadows. Kaol kept his distance. If he caught Adian buying illicit substances, that might be enough to get him to calm down, to keep the parties at a minimum and control the bane when it arrived. Kaol tracked them, mindful of the eyes he passed, every drunk and orphan and beggar. On a forgotten street by the Avery's docks, Adian and the cloaked figure slipped into a crumbling building. It wasn't just any building, not with sentries posted on the corner, by the door, on the rooftop, even milling about the street, trying to blend in. They weren't royal guards or soldiers. It wasn't a place to purchase opiates or flesh, either. He'd been memorizing the information Selena had gathered about the rebels, and had stalked them as often as he'd trailed Adian, mostly to no avail. Selena had claimed they'd been looking for a way to defeat the king's power. Larger implications aside, if he could find out not only how the king had stifled magic, but also how to liberate it before he was dragged back to Aniel, then Dorian's secret might be less explosive. It might help him somehow. And Kaol would always help him. His friend. His prince. He couldn't stop a shiver down his spine as he touched the eye of Elena and realized the derelict building, with this pattern of guards, positively reeked of the rebels' habits. Perhaps it wasn't mere coincidence that had led him here. He was so focused on his thundering heart that Kaol didn't have a chance to turn as a dagger pricked his side. Chapter 19. Kaol didn't put up a fight, though he knew he was as likely to receive death as he was answers. He recognized the sentries by their worn weapons and their fluid, precise movements. He'd never forget those details, not after he'd spent a day being held prisoner in a warehouse by them and witnessed Selena cut through them as though they were stalks of wheat. They'd never known that it had been their lost queen who came to slaughter them. The sentries forced him to his knees in an empty room that smelled of old hay. Kaol found Adian and a familiar-looking old man staring down at him, the one who had begged Selena to stop that night in the warehouse. There was nothing remarkable about the old man. His worn clothes were ordinary, his body lean but not yet withered. Beside him stood a young man Kaol knew by his soft, vicious laugh. The guard who had taunted him when he'd been held prisoner. Shoulder-length dark hair hung loose around a face that was more cruel than handsome, especially with the wicked scar slashing through his eyebrow and down his cheek. He dismissed the sentries with a jerk of his chin. "Well, well," Adian said, circling Kaol. His sword was out, gleaming in the dim light. Captain of the Guard, heir of Aniel, and spy? Or has your lover been giving you some tricks of the trade?
When you throw parties and convince my men to leave their posts, when you're not at those parties because you're sneaking through the streets, it's my duty to know why, Adian.
The scarred young man with the twin swords stepped closer, circling with Adian now. Two predators, sizing up their prey. They'd probably fight over his carcass.
Too bad your champion isn't here to save you this time,
the scarred one said quietly.
Too bad you weren't there to save Archer Finn,
Kaol said. A flare of nostrils, a flash of fury in cunning brown eyes. But the young man fell silent as the old man held out a hand.
Did the king send you?
I came because of him.
Kaol jerked his chin at Adian.
But I've been looking for you two, and your little group as well. Both of you are in danger. Whatever you think Adian wants, whatever he offers you, the king keeps him on a tight leash.
Perhaps that bit of honesty would buy him what he needed, trust and information. But Adian barked out a laugh.
What?
His companions turned to him, brows raised. Kaol glanced at the ring on the general's finger. He hadn't been mistaken. It was identical to the ones the king, Parrington, and others had worn. Adian caught Kaol's look and stopped his circling. For a moment, the general stared at him, a glimmer of surprise and amusement darting across his tan face. Then Adian purred.
You've turned out to be a far more interesting man than I thought, Captain. Explain, Adian.
The old man said softly, but not weakly. Adian smiled broadly as he yanked the black ring off his finger.
The day the king presented me with the Sword of Orinth, he also offered me a ring. Thanks to my heritage, my senses are sharper. I thought the ring smelled strange, and knew only a fool would accept that kind of gift from him. So I had a replica made. The real one I chucked into the sea. But I always wondered what it did, he mused, tossing the ring with one hand and catching it. It seems the captain knows and disapproves.
The man with the twin swords ceased his circling, and the grin he gave Kaol was nothing short of feral.
You're right, Adian,
he said without taking his eyes off Kaol.
He is more interesting than he seems.
Adian pocketed the ring as if it were. As if it were indeed a fake. And Kaol realized that he'd revealed far more than he'd ever intended. Adian began circling again, the scarred young man echoing the graceful movements.
A magical leash, when there is no magic left, the general mused.
And yet you still followed me, believing I was under the king's spell. Thinking you could use me to win the rebels' favor? Fascinating.
Kaol kept his mouth shut. He'd already said enough to damn himself. Adian went on.
These two said your assassin friend was a rebel sympathizer. That she handed over information to Archer Finn without thinking twice. That she allowed rebels to sneak out of the city when she was commanded to put them down. Was she the one who told you about the king's rings? Or did you discover that tidbit all on your own? What exactly is going on in that glass palace when the king isn't looking?
Kaol clamped down on his retort. When it became clear he wouldn't speak, Adian shook his head.
You know how this has to end, Adian said,
and there wasn't anything mocking in it, just cold calculation, the true face of the Northern Wolf.
The way I see it, you signed your own death warrant when you decided to trail me, and now that you know so much. You have two options, Captain.
We can torture it out of you and then we'll kill you. Or you can tell us what you know and we'll make it quick for you. As painless as possible. On my honor. They stopped circling. Kaol had faced death a few times in the past few months. Had faced and seen and dealt it. But this death, where Selena and Dorian and his mother would never know what happened to him, it disgusted him somehow, enraged him. Adian stepped closer to where Kaol knelt. He could take out the scarred one, then hope he could stand against Adian, or at least flee. He would fight, because that was the only way he could embrace this sort of death. Adian's sword was at the ready, the sword that belonged to Selena by blood and right. Kaol had assumed he was a two-faced butcher. Adian was a traitor, but not to Terrasen. Adian had been playing a very dangerous game since arriving here, since his kingdom fell 10 years ago. And tricking the king into thinking that he'd been wearing his ring all this time. That was indeed information Adian would be willing to kill to keep safe. Yet there was other information Kaol could use, perhaps, to get out of this alive. Regardless of how shattered she'd been when she left, Selena was safe now. She was away from Otterlin. But Dorian, with his magic, with the threat he secretly posed, was not. Adian took a readying breath to kill him. Keeping Dorian protected was all he had left, all that had ever really mattered. If these rebels did indeed know something, anything, about magic that might help to free it, if he could use Adian to get that information. It was a gamble. The biggest gamble he'd ever made. Adian raised his sword. With a silent prayer for forgiveness, Kaol looked straight at Adian.
Aelin is alive.
Adian Ashriver had been called wolf, general, prince, traitor, and murderer. And he was all of those things, and more. Liar, deceiver, and trickster were his particular favorites, the titles only those closest to him knew. Otterlin's whore, that's what the ones who didn't know him called him. It was true. In so many ways it was true. And he had never minded it, not really. It had allowed him to maintain control in the north, to keep the bloodshed down to a minimum and a lie. Half the Bane were rebels, and the other half sympathizers. So many of their battles in the north had been staged. The body count a deceit and an exaggeration. At least, once the corpses got up from the killing field under cover of darkness and went home to their families. Otterlin's whore. He had not minded. Until now. Cousin. That had been his most beloved title. Cousin, kin, protector. Those were the secret names he harbored deep within. The names he whispered to himself when the northern wind was shrieking through the staghorns. Sometimes that wind sounded like the screams of his people being led to the butchering blocks. And sometimes it sounded like Aelin. Aelin, whom he had loved, who should have been his queen, and to whom he would have one day sworn the blood oath. Adian stood on the decaying planks of an empty dock in the slums, staring at the Avery. The captain was beside him, spitting blood into the water thanks to the beating given to him by Ren Alsbrook, Adian's newest conspirator and yet another dead man risen from the grave. Ren, heir and lord of Alsbrook, had trained with Adian as a child, and had once been his rival. 10 years ago, Ren and his grandfather Murtaugh had escaped the butchering blocks thanks to a diversion started by Ren's parents that cost them their lives and gave Ren the nasty scar down his face. But Adian hadn't known. He'd thought them dead,
and had been stunned to learn that they were the secret rebel group he'd hunted down upon arriving in Rifthold. He'd heard the claims that Aelin was alive and raising an army, and had dragged himself down from the north to get to the bottom of it and destroy the liars, preferably cutting them up piece by piece. The king's summons had been a convenient excuse. Ren and Murtaugh had instantly admitted that the rumors had been spread by a former member of their rebel group. They had never had or heard of any contact with their dead queen. But seeing Ren and Murtaugh, he'd since wondered who else might have survived. He had never allowed himself to hope that Aelin. Adian set his sword on the wooden rail and ran his scarred fingers down it, taking in the nicks and lines, each mark a tale of legendary battles fought, of great kings long dead. The sword was the last shred of proof that a mighty kingdom had once existed in the north. It wasn't his sword, not really. In those initial days of blood and conquest, the King of Otterlin had snatched the blade from Rogue Alathinius's cooling body and brought it to Rifthold. And there it had stayed, the sword that should have been Aelin's. So Adian had fought for years in those war camps and battlefields, fought to prove his invaluable worth to the king, and had taken everything that was done to him again and again. When he and the Bane won that first battle, and the king had proclaimed him the Northern Wolf and offered him a boon, Adian had asked for the sword. The king attributed the request to an 18-year-old's romanticism, and Adian had swaggered about his own glory until everyone believed that he was a traitorous, butchering bastard who made a mockery of the sword just by touching it. But winning back the sword didn't erase his failure. Even though he'd been 13, and even though he'd been 40 miles away in Orinth when Aelin had been killed on the country estate, he should have stopped it. He'd been sent to her land upon his mother's death to become Aelin's sword and shield, to serve in the court she was supposed to have ruled, that child of kings. So he should have ridden out when the castle erupted with the news that Orlan Galathinius had been assassinated. By the time anyone did, Roe, Evelyn, and Aelin were dead. It was that reminder he'd carried with him on his back. The reminder of who the sword belonged to, and to whom, when he took his last breath and went to the other world, he'd finally give it. But now the sword, that weight he'd embraced for years, felt lighter and sharper. Far more fragile, infinitely precious. The world had slipped from beneath his feet. No one had spoken for a moment after the captain of the guard made his claim. Aelin is alive. Then the captain had said he'd only speak with Adian about it. Just to show they weren't bluffing about torturing him, Ren had bloodied him up with a cool precision that Adian grudgingly admired. But the captain had taken the blows. And whenever Ren paused, Murtaugh looked on disapprovingly. The captain said the same thing. After it became clear that the captain would either tell only Adian or die, he'd called off Ren. The heir of Alsbrook bristled, but Adian had dealt with plenty of young men like him in the war camps. It never took much to get them to fall in line. Adian gave him a long, hard stare, and Ren backed down. Which was how they wound up here, Kaol cleaning off his face with a scrap of his shirt. For the past few minutes, Adian had listened to the most unlikely story he'd ever heard. The story of Selena Sardothian, the infamous assassin, being trained by Aerobin Hommel. The story of her downfall and year in Endovir, and how she'd wound up in the ridiculous competition to become the king's champion. The story of Aelin, his queen, in a death camp, and then serving in her enemy's house. Adian braced his hands on the rail. It couldn't be true. Not after 10 years. 10 years without hope, without proof.
She has your eyes,
Kaol said, working his jaw. If this assassin, an assassin, gods above, was truly Aelin, then she was the king's champion. Then she was the captain's...
You sent her to Wendlin,
Adian said, his voice ragged. The tears would come later. Right now, he was emptied, gutted. Every lie, every rumor and act and party he'd thrown, every battle, real or faked, every life he'd taken so more could live. How would he ever explain that to her? Otterlin's whore.
I didn't know who she was. I just thought she would be safer there because of what she is. You realize you've only given me a bigger reason to kill you.
Adian clenched his jaw.
Do you have any idea what kind of risk you took in telling me? I could be working for the king.
You thought I was in thrall to him, and all you had for proof against it was a quick story. You might as well have killed her yourself.
Fool. Stupid, reckless fool.
But the captain still had the upper hand here. The king's noble captain, who was now towing the line of treason. He'd wondered about the captain's allegiance when Ren told him about the involvement of the king's champion with the rebels, but...
Damn. Aelin.
Aelin was the king's champion. Aelin had helped the rebels and gutted Archer Finn. His knees threatened to buckle, but he swallowed the shock, the surprise and terror, and glimmer of delight.
I know it was a risk, the captain said. But the men who have those rings, something changes in their eyes, a kind of darkness that sometimes manifests physically. I haven't seen it in you since you've been here, and I've never seen someone throw so many parties but only attend for a few minutes. You wouldn't go to such lengths to hide your meetings with the rebels if you were enslaved to the king, especially when during all this time the Bane still hasn't come, despite your assurances that it will be here soon. It doesn't add up.
The captain met his stare. Perhaps not quite a fool, then.
I think she'd want you to know.
The captain looked down the river toward the sea.
This place reeked.
Adian had smelled and seen worse in war camps, but the slums of Rifthold certainly gave them a run for their money. And Terrasen's capital, Orinth, its once shining tower, now a slab of filthy white stone, was well on its way to falling into this level of poverty and despair. But maybe, someday soon. Aelin was alive. Alive and as much of a killer as he was, and working for the same man.
Does the prince know?
He'd never been able to speak with the prince without remembering the days before Terrasen's downfall. He'd never been able to hide that hatred.
No. He doesn't even know why I sent her to Wendlin. Or that she's... You're both... Fae.
Adian had never possessed a fraction of the power that had smoldered in her veins, which had burned libraries and caused such general worry that there had been talk, in those months before the world went to hell, of sending her somewhere so that she could learn to control it. He'd overheard debate over packing her off to various academies or tutors in distant lands, but never to their Aunt Maeve, waiting like a spider in a web to see what became of her niece. And yet she'd wound up in Wendlin, on her aunt's doorstep. Maeve had either never known or never cared about his inherited gifts. No, all he had were some of the physical traits of their immortal kin. Strength, swiftness, sharp hearing, keen smell. It had made him a formidable opponent on the battlefield, and saved his life more than once. Saved his very soul if the captain was right about those rings.
Is she coming back?
Adian asked quietly. The first of the many, many questions he had for the captain,
now that he'd proved himself to be more than a useless servant of the king. There was enough agony in the captain's eyes that Adian knew that he loved her. Knew, and felt a tug of jealousy, if only because the captain knew her that well.
I don't know,
Kaol admitted. If he hadn't been his enemy, Adian would have respected the man for the sacrifice implied. But Aelin had to come back. She would come back. Unless that return only earned her a walk to the butchering block. He would sort through each wild thought when he was alone. He gripped the damp rail harder, fighting the urge to ask more. But then the captain gave him a weighing look, as if he could see through every mask Adian had ever worn. For a heartbeat, Adian considered putting the blade right through the captain and dumping his body in the Avery, despite the information he possessed. The captain glanced at the blade, too, and Adian wondered if he was thinking the same thing, regretting his decision to trust him. The captain should regret it, should curse himself for a fool. Adian said, Why were you tracking the rebels?
Because I thought they might have valuable information.
It had to be truly valuable, then, if he'd risk revealing himself as a traitor to get it. Adian had been willing to torture the captain, to kill him, too. He'd done worse before. But torturing and killing his queen's lover wouldn't go over well if... when she returned. And the captain was now his greatest source of information. He wanted to know more about Aelin, about her plans, about what she was like and how he could find her. He wanted to know everything, anything, especially where the captain now stood on the game board and what the captain knew about the king. So Adian said, Tell me more about those rings. But the captain shook his head.
I want to make a bargain with you.
Chapter 20. The black eye was still gruesome, but it improved over the next week as Selena worked in the kitchens, tried and failed to shift with Rowan, and generally avoided everyone. The spring rains had come to stay, and the kitchen was packed every night. So Selena took to eating dinner on the shadowed steps, arriving just before the storykeeper began speaking. Storykeeper. That's what Emrys was, a title of honor amongst both Fae and humans in Wendlin. What it meant was that when he began telling a story, you sat down and shut up. It also meant that he was a walking library of the kingdom's legends and myths. By that time, Selena knew most of the fortress's residents, if only in the sense that she could put names to faces. She'd observed them out of instinct, to learn her surroundings, her potential enemies and threats. She knew they observed her, too, when they thought she wasn't paying attention. And any shred of regret she felt at not approaching them was burned up by the fact that no one bothered to approach her, either. The only person who made an effort was Luca, who still peppered Selena with questions as they worked, still prattled on and on about his training, the fortress gossip, the weather. He'd only talked to her once about anything else. On a morning when it had taken a monumental effort to peel herself out of bed, and only the scar on her palm had made her plant her feet on the icy floor. She'd been washing the breakfast dishes, staring out the window without seeing anything. Too heavy in her bones. When Luca had dumped a pot in the sink and quietly said,
For a long while, I couldn't talk about what happened to me before I came here. There were some days I couldn't talk at all. Couldn't get out of bed, either. But if, when you need to talk.
She'd shut him down with a long look, and he hadn't said anything like it since. Thankfully, Emrys gave her space. Lots of space, especially when Malachi arrived during breakfast to make sure Selena hadn't caused any trouble.
She usually avoided looking at the other fortress couples. But here, where she couldn't walk away, she hated their closeness, the way Malachi's eyes lit up every time he saw him. Hated it so much that she choked on it. She never asked Rowan why he, too, came to hear Emrys' stories. As far as they were each concerned, the other didn't exist outside of training. Training was a generous way to describe what they were doing, as she had accomplished nothing. She didn't shift once. He snarled and sneered and hissed, but she couldn't do it. Every day, always when Rowan disappeared for a few moments, she tried, but nothing. Rowan threatened to drag her back to the barrows, as that seemed to be the only thing that had triggered any sort of response. But he'd backed off, to her surprise, when she told him that she'd slit her own throat before entering that place again. So they swore at each other, sat in brooding silence on the temple ruin, and occasionally had those unspoken shouting matches. If she was in a particularly nasty mood, he made her chop wood, log after log, until she could hardly lift the axe and her hands were blistered. If she was going to be pissed off at the whole damn world, he said, if she was going to waste his time by not shifting, then she might as well be useful in some way. All this waiting. For her. For the shift that made her shudder to think about. It was on the 8th day after her arrival, after scrubbing pots and pans until her back throbbed, that Selena stopped in the middle of their hike up the now familiar ridge. I have a request. She never spoke to him unless she needed to, mostly to curse at him. Now, she said, I want to see you shift. A blink, those green eyes flat. You don't have the privilege of giving orders. Show me how you do it. Her memories of the Fae and Terrasen were foggy, as if someone had smeared oil over them. She couldn't remember seeing one of them change, where their clothes had gone, how fast it had been. He stared her down, seeming to say, just this once, and then a soft flash of light, a ripple of color, and a hawk was flapping midair, beating for the nearest tree branch. He settled on it, clicking his beak. She scanned the mossy earth. No sign of his clothes, his weapons. It had taken barely more than a few heartbeats. He gave a battle cry and swooped, talons slashing for her eyes. She lunged behind the tree just as there was another flash and a shudder of color. And then he was clothed and armed and growling in her face. Your turn. She wouldn't give him the satisfaction of seeing her tremble. It was incredible. Incredible to see the shift. Where do your clothes go? Between somewhere. I don't particularly care. Such dead, joyless eyes. She had a feeling she looked like that these days. She knew she had looked like that the night Kaol had caught her gutting Archer in the tunnel. What had left Rowan so soulless? He bared his teeth, but she didn't submit. She'd been watching the Demi-Fey warrior males at the fortress, and they growled and showed their teeth about everything. They were not the ethereal gentlefolk that legend painted, that she vaguely remembered from Terrasen. No holding hands and dancing around the maypole with flowers in their hair. They were predators, the lot of them. Some of the dominant females were just as aggressive, prone to snarling when challenged or annoyed or even hungry. She supposed she might have fit in with them if she'd bothered to try. Still holding Rowan's stare, Selena calmed her breathing. She imagined phantom fingers reaching down, pulling her fey form out. Imagined a wash of color and light. Pushed herself against her mortal flesh, but nothing. Sometimes I wonder whether this is a punishment for you, she said through her teeth.
But what could you have done to piss off her immortal majesty?
Don't use that tone when you talk about her.
Oh, I can use whatever tone I want. And you can taunt and snarl at me and make me chop wood all day. But short of ripping out my tongue, you can't... Faster than lightning, his hand shot out and she gagged, jolting as he grabbed her tongue between her fingers. She bit down, hard, but he didn't let go.
Say that again,
he purred. She choked as he kept pinching her tongue, and she went for his daggers, simultaneously slamming her knee up between his legs. But he shoved his body against hers, a wall of hard muscle and several hundred years of lethal training trapping her against a tree. She was a joke by comparison. A joke. And her tongue. He released her tongue, and she gasped for breath. She swore at him, a filthy, foul name, and spat at his feet. And that's when he bit her. She cried out, as those canines pierced the spot between her neck and shoulder, a primal act of aggression, the bite so strong and claiming that she was too stunned to move. He had her pinned against the tree and clamped down harder, his canines digging deep, her blood spilling onto her shirt. Pinned like some weakling. But that was what she'd become, wasn't it? Useless. Pathetic. She growled, more animal than sentient being, and shoved. Rowan staggered back a step, teeth ripping her skin as she struck his chest. She didn't feel the pain, didn't care about the blood or the flash of light. No, she wanted to rip his throat out, rip it out with the elongated canines she bared at him, as she finished shifting and roared. Chapter 21. Rowan grinned.
There you are.
Blood. Her blood was on his teeth, on his mouth and chin. And those dead eyes glowed as he spat her blood onto the earth. She probably tasted like a sewer to him. There was a shrieking in her ears, and Selena lunged at him. Lunged, and then stopped, as she took in the world with stunning clarity. Smelled it, and tasted it, and breathed it like the finest wine. Gods, this place, this kingdom smelled divine, smelled like... She had shifted. She panted, even though her lungs were telling her she was no longer winded and did not need as many breaths in this body. There was a tickling at her neck. Her skin slowly began to stitch itself together. She was a faster healer in this form, because of the magic... Breathe. Breathe. But there it was, rising up, wildfire crackling in her veins, in her fingertips, the forest around them so much kindling. And then, she shoved back, took the fear and used it like a battering ram inside herself, against the power, shoving it down, down. Rowan prowled closer.
Let it out. Don't fight it.
A pulse beat against her, nipping, smelling of snow and pine. Rowan's power, taunting hers. Not like her fire,